show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Now, where were we? Let's see. When last we spoke, you probably heard me sort of fading off into the distance. Flag staggin' blassel frassel that nassin' blood not pulled neck rackin'. Yeah. Highly frustrating the last night was. And frankly, I still don't, it's only fair warning, I still don't have the problem solved. So there's no guarantee that we'll make it through 3 hours tonight. But I hope you all have a very happy holiday weekend. My weekend will be made deliriously happy with a victory over the Duke. Come about starting about, what, 8:47 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Saturday evening when my beloved Mountaineers tip off against Mike Krzyzewski and his shiny-faced, smiling band of thugs. No, really, where were we? I'd just gotten a show started, got an hour of it under my belt, had very good news yesterday, and then nothing. But again, no guarantees about tonight either, because I haven't really solved the problem. I don't know if we've got a router problem, a wire problem, or the virus problem. All the virus scans say, no, it's not a virus issue. Among other things, our cavalcade of crazy correspondent from headonradionetwork.com, that's Reverbo, sent me a note earlier saying, when you find a spare 3 minutes, tell me why your internet signal just drops off like last night. Fortunately, it doesn't happen often. I wish it didn't happen never. Or I wish it happened never. Double negative there. Sorry. He says, Reverbo says, perhaps next time you'll put in a repair ticket with Central Services like you should have. Because Central Services takes care of all repairs in the socialist bureaucratic nightmare world that you wanted. Or at least in Terry Gilliam's wonderful world of Brazil from 1985, one of my favorite films. You know, Bob, if you try to fix things yourself, Central Services will find out. And then when they send Dowser and Spore, Bob Hoskins, over in clear hazmat suits and caps with bills about a foot long, they will be none too pleased with you. Oh, how true. How true it is. How very true. And that's the thing. I've tried to get help from Central Services, but, you know, that's what happens when you try to, when you try to get help from Central Services. This is, of course, so-called Good Friday. Marty noting that I may have teed off the Mossad, or something. One never knows. One never knows. Maybe I may have teed off the Guardians of the Free Republic. Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, we got that story in the stack tonight. How could we not? Oh, this is lots of stories in the stack tonight. But it is, you know, it is the Easter season. And it occurs to me to note that, you know, I did, before the program, it was sort of an academic exercise. I went back and I read the Gospel of Mark, and I'm going to share a couple of chapters with you of it in a couple of minutes, because I want to make sure that you hear what I read. Because I couldn't find that part in the Easter story where there's a rabbit being crucified next to Yeshua. I couldn't. And maybe it's maybe St. Eusebius or something covered that up. Who knows? But it occurs to me that Easter, this particular holiday, is as much a function of our common language as any holiday. It may be the oldest holiday on the calendar, because the word shares a certain commonality with Ishtar and Astarte and Ehostra, all of whom were goddesses of one sort or another, highly revered ones at that, whose worship traverses from Europe all the way down into South Asia. And it's worth remembering that we, you know, sure, we English is designated a Germanic tongue, and yet 70% of the words in the English language are in one way or another Latin-derived. We share a certain commonality with French, with German, that comes through Latin. But whether it be Latin or Greek or German or Russian or any... They all fall into a branch on the grand tree of human language called Indo-European. So that actually there's a common language branch, a commonality to practically every language spoken from the Hadrian's Wall in the UK all the way to the Ganges, because they are all Indo-European. And that's why Easter may be one of our oldest holidays, simply because it's the rebirth festival that has been celebrated in the name of Ishtar, Astarte, Ehostra. And a local Jewish boy made good became that festival 2.1 beta about 2,000 years ago, when his murder transformed into the fertility festival and the fertility cult, hence the fact that there are still Easter rabbits, which are prolific in their reproduction, and eggs, which are the very symbol of rebirth, involved with the crucifixion story. Of course, this year it just so happens that Passover, or Pesach in Hebrew, is happening at the same time as Easter. Doesn't always roll out that way, and there's not even certainty as to whether or not the first one was, though many have made that argument. Passover will be, I guess, what, ending at sundown Saturday? Whereas the Holy Week, so-called, will conclude sometime on Sunday. The early Christian church fathers weren't that good with numbers or apparently astronomy or the movements of the planet. It's just Sunday. Never mind the fact that, assuming for a moment that there really was a rising from the dead, it didn't happen on Sunday. Happened on the Sabbath, the Shabbat. That would be early in the morning on Saturday, which would mean that the Holy Church at Rome's got another problem in that they've got another thing wrong. But then again, they could never really come to a really solid agreement with the Greek Orthodox Church as to just exactly when Easter was going to be. The Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, the Serbian Orthodox, and all the other Orthodoxies will, of course, be celebrating Easter sometime hence from now. God knows thousands of people were probably slaughtered over a disagreement over the calendar, but, you know, Christianity's good at that. But I thought a reading would be in order. And seeing as how it is the oldest extant gospel, I thought that reading should probably come from Mark, beginning with chapter 14. After 2 days was the feast of the Passover and of unleavened bread, and the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by craft and put him to death. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar of the people. And being in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper as he sat at meat, there came a woman having an alabaster box of ointment of spikenard, very precious, and she brake the box and poured it on his head. Hey, what are you doing? Now, I guess she meant to, and it was... And there were some that had indignation within in themselves and said, why was this waste of the ointment made? Oh, where have we heard that before? Liberals. Oil and spend, oil and spend. Tax and oil, tax and oil. Tax and anoint, tax and anoint. And there were some that had indignation within themselves and said, why was this waste of the ointment made? For it might have been sold for more than 300 pence and have been given to the poor. And they murmured against her. And Yeshua said, let her alone. Why trouble ye her? She hath wrought a good work on me. For ye have the poor with you always, and whensoever ye will, ye may do them good, but me ye have not always. See, that's a joke. See, this is all written so seriously that we can't see the joke. Try it again. The poor, you're always with you. And whenever you feel like it, you can do some good for the poor. But me, not so much. See, it's a joke. Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached throughout the whole world, this also that she hath done shall be spoken of for a memorial of her. And Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Yeah, because Judas didn't really want to put himself out. Sheesh. And the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, where wilt thou that we go and prepare that thou mayst eat the Passover? Hey, boss, where you want to eat? And he sendeth forth two of his disciples, and saith unto them, go ye into the city, and there shall meet you a man bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wheresoever he shall go, say ye unto the goodman of the house, the master saith, where is the guest chamber where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will shew you a large upper room, finished and prepared. There make ready for us. And his disciples went forth and came into the city, and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And in the evening he cometh with the 12. And as they sat and did eat, Jesus said, verily I say unto you, one of you which eateth with me shall betray me. And they began to be sorrowful, and to say unto him one by one, is it I? And another said, is it I? You know, this is a good time to remind you that the disciples were not the brightest knives in the drawer, sharpest knives in the drawer, nor the brightest candles flickering in the lamp. No. Is it me? Is it me? At which point I think Jesus gets to, yeah, stupid, and smack him upside the back of the head. And they began, and he answered them and said unto them, it is one of the 12 that dippeth with me in the dish. Well, thanks for all the help. The Son of Man indeed goeth, as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it for that man if he had never been born. You know, that's not a damnation, though. That's a very interesting little moment in the story. He said, you know, it's going to be tough for that guy. He's probably going to wind up thinking it would be better if he hadn't been born. He doesn't say, I curse him. He doesn't say, I damn him. He is merely observing fact. But he still acknowledges that the guy who does the betraying is an agent of what's going down. And as they did eat, Jesus took bread and blessed and brake it and gave it to them and said, take, eat. Eat. This is my body. And he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And he said unto them, this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many. Interesting that the cup, the wine in the cup, is the blood, as opposed to his blood being the blood. But, again, nuance not so much among the disciples. Verily I say unto you, I will drink no more of the fruit of the vine until that day that I drink it new in the kingdom of God. And Jesus saith unto them, all ye shall be offended, because of me this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered. But after that I am risen, I will go before you into Galilee. But Peter said unto him, although all shall be offended, yet will not I. And Jesus saith unto him, verily I say unto thee, that this day, even in this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And they came to a place which was named Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, sit ye here while I pray. And he taketh with him Peter and James and John, and began to be sore amazed, and to be very heavy, and saith unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here, and watch. And he went forward a little, and fell on the ground, and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but thou wilt. And he cometh, and he findeth them sleeping. What did I say about the disciples? Jesus, it's like a Three Stooges cart, the short. And he findeth them sleeping, and saith unto Peter, Simon, sleepest thou? Couldst thou not watch 1 hour? Watch ye and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. The spirit truly is ready, but the flesh is weak. And again he went away and prayed and spake the same words, and when he returned, he found them asleep again! Remind you of Sam Kennison? Hi, honey, I'm home. Where you been? With my disciples. You mean those losers? Well, they're my disciples. They're losers! You know, I think Sam Kennison, because, you know, remember, Sam Kennison was a trained, taught, raised-up Pentecostal preacher. If you've never seen the clip of the late, great Sam Kennison doing his Pentecostal preacher shtick, you really owe that to yourself. But so he went away and said, spake the same words, and when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. Oh, yeah. Well, this is Mark's gospel, and it was allegedly Dick sort of, he was taking notes when Peter was talking, and Peter's one of the ones that was snoozing. So there's a built-in excuse inside it. Neither wist they what to answer him. I don't know, boss. I fell asleep. And he cometh the third time, and saith unto them, sleep on now, take your rest, it's enough, the hour is come, behold, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of the sinners. In other words, thanks a million! Thanks for nothing! And immediately, while he yet spake, cometh Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves, from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And he that betrayed him had given them a token, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, that same is he. Take him and lead him away safely. Like they didn't know what Jesus looked like? They were all in a froth about Jesus, and they didn't know what the guy looked like? But listen to that. Whomsoever I shall kiss, the same is he. Take him and lead him away safely. Safely. Now, if you think that you're just handing over a guy who's going to go and get killed, what's it to you to tell him to take him away safely? And they laid their hands on him and took him. Now, did you miss? I did, because I don't see it about the flashing of swords and avast, yar. No, it's not there, is it? And one of them that stood by drew a sword, see, and smote a servant of the high priest. One of them that stood by. That isn't one of the bad guys. They came with swords and staves, but there's nothing in there about the swords ever being drawn or the staves being pointed at anyone. But one that was of them that was with, that stood by drew a sword and smote a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus answered and said unto them, are you come out as against a thief with swords and with staves to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you took me not, but the scriptures must be fulfilled. And they all forsook him and fled. And there followed him a certain young man, having with him having a linen cloth cast about his naked body, and the young man laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. Oh, there's one in every crowd. And they led Jesus away to the high priest. With him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, and Peter followed from way off, even unto the place of the high priest. And he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. And the chief priests and all the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. And there arose certain and bare false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another one without hands. But neither so did their witness agree together. This is a comedy of errors. This is not Mel Gibson's Passion. This is one of those stories where everything goes sideways. Nothing is as it was meant to be. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee?" But he held his peace and answered nothing. Ooh, look, where do you reckon Gandhi and Dr. King got the notion of passive resistance? Because, you know, it's real easy to... It's lies, it's lies, it's all lies, you're all a bunch of liars, you're lying liars! And when you start that, because you're screwed from the get-go, because it's all a carnival show. The ending's pre-written, not by prophecy, but by the nature of bureaucracy itself. You've heard the blasphemy. What think ye? What need we any further witnesses? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And some began to spit on him, and to cover his face, and to buffet him, and to say unto him, Prophesy! And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands. And as Peter was beneath the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, And thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied it, saying, I know not, neither understand. Me no habla Hebrew. Okay? And he went out onto the porch, and the cock went cock-a-doodle-doo. And a maid saw him again, and began to say to them that stood by, he's one of them, I'm telling you, he's one of them. And he denied it again. And a little bit after, they stood by and said again to Peter, surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto. In other words, I would know that accent anywhere. Don't pretend like you're from Jerusalem, because you don't have the Jerusalem accent. At which point Peter began to curse and to swear, saying, in addition, you know, because they don't give you the cursing and the swearing, I know not this man of whom you speak. And the second time, the cock crew, cock-a-doodle-doo again. And Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said unto him, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. You know what? Johnny Cochran couldn't have done better. And when he thought thereon, he wept, saying, yea, verily, unto himself, I'm such a schmuck. And it goes on like this. And there's no rabbits. There are absolutely no rabbits. No eggs. But they had to have something to overlay the pagan festivals of Ishtar and Astarte and, what was it, the Temple of Diana. Diana was another manifestation, wasn't she? Oh, yeah. What's most interesting after you get through all the, all the carrying on, you know, they crucified Jesus just like the Romans crucified 6,000 members of the Spartacus uprising in, what, 71 B.C.? And just as the Babylonians, crucifixion was big. In the earliest days of humanity, it took some work to figure out how to kill another human being, if you think about it. So they crucify him. And they stick him in a hole. And the centurion gives the body to Joseph of Arimathea. And he brought fine linen and took him down and wrapped him in the linen and laid him in a sepulcher which was hewn out of a rock and rolled a stone unto the door of the sepulcher. And Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Jesus, of Jesus beheld where he was laid. Okay? And when the Sabbath was passed, this would be Sunday morning. Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome had brought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him, because that's what you did. Now, in that same time frame, eventually, after he'd been all wrapped and anointed and everything, it's the climate and everything, and the flesh is weak, and so you're left with nothing but bones, and you take the bones and you stick them in a little box. It's called an ossuary. It was a tradition of about, 200 years tradition within the Hebrew community there at the time. And you stick all the bones in a little box, and you write Jesus on the outside, just like the ossuary that was. But, you know, it's like a Savior rising now in this culture, and the Savior's name is Fred. There's lots of Freds. There were lots of Yeshuas, so just finding an ossuary, a bone box, that says Jesus across the side is really no proof. Even if it says Jesus, son of Joseph, there weren't that many names. And Yeshua bar Yusuf, still pretty common. That's like Fred, son of Sam. Oh, let's not say son of Sam. Fred, son of Bill. Okay? But what's interesting is in the original version of Mark, and when they looked, they saw the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. And entering into the sepulcher, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. And it ends. The rest of the stuff that's in there, but he that believeth not shall be damned, and these signs shall follow them that they believe in my name, shall they cast out devils, they shall speak with new tongues. They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and that all ain't in there. That was made up about 200 years later. The miracle, if there be miracles, was in the life of Yeshua. For coming up with ideas that were totally foreign to the people and the culture in which he lived. The idea that one should love his neighbor. Granted, the idea that one should love one's enemy even. Granted, Socrates came up with that 300 years before. And guess what? The ancient Greeks killed him for that, too, because it was deemed to be corrupting of the youth to suggest such things. It was even atheism. It was heresy. You know, you can just see Socrates sitting there on the bench getting ready to drink the hemlock. What are your last words, Socrates? You want my last words? Here's my last words. All my life, Socrates, what is truth? Socrates, what is beauty? Never, not once, Socrates, hemlock's poison. So, we've gotten the Easter stuff out of the way, and we've still got a viable stream, and, knock wood, we may have a show tonight. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, it's 304-658-3333. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. And here is my favorite, my all-time favorite Easter song.
Gold sun rolls around, chocolate nipple brown, tumble from your arms like the ground. Your breasts swell and awake from sleep. Hairs will kick and leap, flowers climb erect, smiling from the moist field.
understand why I love that song so much? Damn, that's beautiful. That is just exquisite. You know, I don't know why I don't spend more time listening to XTC. Andy Partridge, one of the sharpest, and Colin Moulding, brilliant lyricist. And that particular song, Easter Theater, from XTC's album, Apple Venus Part 1, I just love it. Because the one thing that it does do is it acknowledges the role of the goddess. It acknowledges the role of the feminine. It acknowledges what the church would manifest as Sophia, and would spend so much time trying to suppress. Yeah, how much did Christianity miss out on in 2,000 years of this sick, disgusting misogyny that is manifesting itself even unto this day? How much spirituality was missed? How much real and genuine mysticism was gone? You know, but that lyric, it's just the gold sun rolls around, chocolate nipple brown, tumble from your arms like the ground your breasts swell, land awake from sleep, hairs will kick and leap, flowers climb erect, smiling from the moist kiss of her rainbow mouth. Gives me chills. Wow. Enter Easter, and she's dressed in yellow yoke. Stage right, now the son has died, the father can be born. Stand up, if we'd all breathe in and blow away the smoke, new life. We'd applaud a new life. Wow. Yeah. Loves it. Just loves it. Let's go to the phones. Stop this shilly-shallying about. It is, after all, Good Friday on the front porch. The sun is shining. Ah, it's nice outside. Got up around 89 degrees here. Yeah, so much for spring. And away we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Scott from Salem. How you doing?
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Wanted to thank you for the little invite you sent my way today.
Oh, my pleasure. Wouldn't have happened without our buddy Patrick there in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. Just so everyone knows, we actually used the social network for some social good. It was really, really nice. Someone had a ticket they weren't going to be able to use up here at the drive-by truckers show.
Yeah, I was going to say, not just any ticket. That's a trucker's ticket.
Yeah, no kidding. And we actually just bought that album, so I've been really enjoying it.
What are you thinking of it so far?
I like it. I mean, I think it's, we've listened to it, I think, twice, you know. It's really good, though. I mean, it's the only one of theirs that we have. So it's been really, really enjoyable. But I'm going to make you veer. I'm going to make you veer on Friday on the porch.
Friday on the front porch is all about the veering.
Exactly. So fasten your seatbelts. I wanted to, you know, it's been a long time since we've talked.
It has been.
But a couple of things with you. I want to get your thoughts on them. First of all, I wanted to talk, it's this thread that's been going through quite a bit, about the sort of, you know, anger, the political anger that's in the air these days, I mean, especially with the healthcare legislation just having passed.
Right.
And you know, it's been very interesting. And Linda had a really interesting insight about this. I think she read something about it. We talked about it a bit, and I think it really captures it. And I've got some sort of personal anecdotes that I think tie it together too with the whole Scott Brown thing and. Just what's happening there. And that the basic idea is that really what you're seeing here is you're seeing basically white men realizing that their day is over.
I absolutely think you're right.
So if you think about the demographics of these people at the Tea Party rallies, right? Yeah, you have to ask yourself, why are so many people who are actually going to benefit from the healthcare package so angry about it, right? It's not just, you know, executives of insurance companies and, you know, say whether they're going to benefit from it or not, but, you know, it's not just sort of the traditional rich white Republican, right? The Republicans have tapped a very interesting nerve with sort of the disaffected middle class and lower middle class white guy, right? I mean, middle-aged person who recognizes that the world has changed under their feet, right? That this is becoming. I remember, so there's some personal anecdotes that would be interesting for you.
Absolutely. Yes, and you're right. The anger is completely out of proportion with that, because even the over the top stuff, Scott. You know, the socialism, communism, communo fascism, things that don't even exist. It's still too over the. It's clinical, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's
or I should say, I guess maybe pathological is the better choice.
Yeah, I mean, it's irrational, right? So you have to ask yourself when you're confronted with something like that, you say, okay, so what's the real reason then, right? What are you really talking about? Because you can't be talking about socialism and fascism because it makes no sense, right? That's not what you're talking about. So I remember we were at before the election, we were with the in-laws, which is always an educational experience, and we were asking, you know, we try not to talk about politics, though, you know. That doesn't usually happen. And we were asking about, just in an offhand way, just sort of, what do you think of Obama as a candidate? I think this was even before it was clear that he was the front runner. I think he and Hillary were still going at it. And the first thing that came up is, I don't like him. He's going to take my guns. Okay, so we can just throw that aside, right? People who like the Second Amendment, okay, fine, whatever.
Yeah, more guns being sold now than in the history of the United States. Right.
Yeah, so that's fine. But the second thing I thought was really interesting was the comment that I'm just concerned that he's going to pay attention to what's good for his people. And
there's 7 or 8 different directions in which you can run screaming into the night on that one, Scott.
Right. But that's where the socialism comes from, right? Socialism is wealth redistribution, right?
Right.
That's what's the boogeyman about socialism, is it actually destroys the structure of the inequitable distribution of wealth and redistributes it. Now, if you're a conservative, the only real good reason to be a conservative is if, as you're standing there today, you're actually doing better than the guy next to you. And then you want the status quo maintained. That's the fundamentals of conservatism. It's like, don't change anything. The system works great.
For me.
Right? For me.
Which is, was it Hobbes or Locke, you know, one of those guys
right.
who coined the phrase about enlightened self-interest?
Yeah, and the behind the veil.
Right.
This idea that, you know, if you didn't know how it was going to turn out for you, if you imagine that you hadn't been born yet, and you ask, what kind of system would I want to have? Right? If I don't know whether I'm going to be born poor or rich, you tend to have these sort of egalitarian ideas of sharing and so forth, right?
Right.
Because you don't know how it's going to turn out. But when you do know how it turned out, and you know that you did better than average, then you have this idea of meritocracy and the libertarian idea, just leave me alone, get out of my way, you know, don't.
Life is good.
Yeah, life is good, exactly. And this is the way it ought to be, right? I'm richer than other people because that's the way it should be, right? So I think that's where the socialism thing comes in, right? The socialism thing comes in, because it's totally not socialism. We all understand that, right? I mean, government doesn't actually own the banks. The government gave the banks money to keep them liquid. If they owned them, it would actually maybe even be a good investment, right?
Right.
But I think what you're seeing there is you're seeing these people recognizing the browning of this country, right? I mean, it's becoming a much, and this is why people who live in urban places are like, what's the big deal? You know, there's all kinds of different people around all the time. You know, it makes sense to have various support mechanisms so people can, you know, get guaranteed loans to go to school and lift themselves up. That's just equality, right?
Well, and I mean, you know, the people who do that, it benefits the whole of society, right? And it might even benefit the people who feel like they're being benefited enough already. It might turn out that they can be even wealthier because of, you know, Thomas Edison was deemed an idiot, you know, all the way through grammar school. Because I guess maybe he was dyslexic and. You know, he was slow.
Yeah, disinterested, yeah.
Right, and if you think about education at the time that Thomas Edison was a sixth grader, I dare say a whole bunch of us would be termed slow.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. And what's curious in all of this, Scott, is the fact that you can take that. There's something else at work there too, and that is this notion that, for instance, I guess you've seen or maybe heard where some of the teabaggers have come out and said, "Sure as shooting, I'd repeal Social Security." And when in fact it was our buddy Tosh who pointed out to me in an email that the fact of the matter is during the Depression and before the Depression, you know, during the good times, a vast majority of America's elderly were living lives of wretched, wretched poverty.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, there was a real need for something, and frankly, probably more than what Social Security was. If you go back and you listen to the old speeches of Huey Long, you know, FDR didn't go far enough to suit him. He wanted some serious income redistribution.
Right, right. But, you know, but this is actually, it's funny, because that's actually the fight, right? The fight goes back to pre-FDR. You know, so there's this, there are these, okay, so we're both sort of law geeks, right? So we know this, these ideas of the sort of ethics of American law. You know, you had the Constitution as it stood, right? Then you had, the Civil War and the Civil War amendments to the Constitution. And then you had FDR and the rise of the administrative state.
Right. Well, you can make a certain argument. Oh dear, we may turn into real live law geeks here in a minute. You can make an argument that the first rumblings of the rise of the administrative state come during the Lincoln administration and immediately thereafter.
Right, right, absolutely, yep.
But putting the government in a position to actually try to, and I think this is the distinction between the administrative state of Lincoln and post-Lincoln and the administrative state that arose with FDR, is that the administrative state as it arose with FDR was an overt attempt to have government really attend to the general welfare of all the people.
Right, absolutely.
As the Constitution mandates.
Yes, yes. Depending on who's reading it, yeah. But, I mean, what we have now, right, is we have a Supreme Court and a conservative movement that actually wants to go back, right? It wants to go back pre-FDR. It wants to go back maybe even, you know, back pre-Lochner, right, where it wants to say, you know what? The general welfare doesn't really mean that. Right? General welfare means the military and...
Yeah, the welfare of the generals.
Yeah, but they're doing fine, I think, most of them. But, I mean, this is how radical they are, right? These are people that are still pissed off about stuff that happened in 1865.
And that's
right?
Because they have very, very...
1920.
They have, one, Scott, they have very, very long memories, and this is not a moment, this is not me talking down, this is one of those sort of yodeling across the cultural divide. Look at who is leading this fight. You know, once you get outside the University of Chicago, look who's leading this fight. It's the same group of people who may well have had forebears who drove around in the 56 Pontiac with the front bumper tag with that little, you know, the grizzled old Confederate soldier that I've talked about once from time to time. He's got a tattered Confederate flag on a pole stick over his shoulder, and he's got his butternut on and his little campaign hat on, and it just says "Forget Hail."
Mm-hmm.
And look who's driving this movement. You know, this movement isn't being granted. You know, if you want to talk about how the teabag parties got started, yeah, that's Americans for Prosperity. Yeah, that's the Dick Army Freedom Works Group, and yeah, that's K Street, and yeah, that's Washington, D.C. But the so-called intellectualism and the grunt work is being done by the old Confederacy. It really is, Scott.
Well, this is what's so interesting about the Scott Brown thing up here in Massachusetts. So we haven't had the chance to talk about that, but let me tell you another sort of personal anecdote, right? So I joined the YMCA a while ago, and, you know, the YMCA is a fascinating cultural experiment, you know, sliced through culture. It's really, really interesting. And I didn't really realize that there are this many conservative people in Massachusetts, right? I had some idea that what you were talking about is these people from, you know, people from other places. You know, Massachusetts is like California. It's even more liberal in some ways than California. But what you see is you see a real, and this is the other piece of it that I think makes it more potent than just, I don't want to say this without being too pejorative, but, you know, just, you know, a forget hell no kind of people, right? I mean, these are a group of people who you have to look at the way they're acting and ask yourself, why are they acting as though someone is actually trying to take food directly out of their mouths, right? Like they're going to starve if they don't get this thing overturned, right? So I'm in the locker room at the Y. There's this old guy in there, old white guy in there. And I hear him say, I'm walking up to my locker, and I hear him say, yeah, line him up against the wall and shoot him, right? And I said, well, okay, this is going to be good. So I say, so who are we shooting today? And the guy says, we're shooting Obama, God damn it, right? I'm like, oh, that's nice. Okay, so we're going to shoot the president that was elected by the majority of the people in the country. I said, while we're at it, why don't we just shoot everybody that voted for him? And then we'll have the kind of country we want, which is a country where half the people that disagree with you are all dead. That's what these people think, that the country is them. Right? They think the country's being taken away from them.
Yeah, and they will tell you, they'll tell you they're colorblind, but they're colorblind because they can't see half of the country.
Exactly. They don't see it, literally do not see it. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I have a famous quote from, I'm not beat my in-laws up too much. Let's just imagine a hypothetical set of in-laws. Like that Twitter feed, that was like crazy shit my dad says.
Oh, God, I love that.
Yeah, so let's just imagine someone else say, poor people, I don't see any poor people.
Yes.
They don't even see them. It's amazing, you know?
And to run way back, Scott, to your original premise, you know, they're worried about he's going to pay more attention to his people.
Right.
Really? That's where we still are in 2010, then. His people. I mean, these are the same people. Come on. Scott, this is the same mindset that said, well, you know, I don't think I can vote for that John Kennedy because he's going to take his orders from the Pope.
From the Pope, yep.
Because some, and I suspect that there is a psychology behind this where what these people are doing, and I hate saying things like these people, it makes me feel as creepy as I think they are.
I was just going to say that because we, rational people or whatever, need to be very careful of using the word them.
And I am.
If you do that, you've.
I'm grammatically challenged on this, Scott, because I think, and I don't think it's transference per se, but I think that the folks who express themselves in this fashion, I think they express themselves in that fashion because that is how they think. And see,
difficult. I know, but yeah.
But what I'm saying here is that if they had the power, they would look after their people, and they do define their people that narrowly. And that's what's been going on for the last 200 and some odd years.
Exactly.
Is white folks have been taking care of their people. You can't exactly claim that Hispanics. Let's narrow it down to WASPs,
Japanese,
Scott.
Around World War II.
Irish need not apply. Don't let the sun set on you here. No WASPs. And that's all, you know, that's, and it's manifested in the likes of Tom Tancredi. You know, a guy whose name ends in a vowel, talking about sending other people whose names end in vowels home because they're not like us enough.
Well, you know what you're doing. You're challenging American exceptionalism.
Right, because apparently America takes exception to anybody who's new here.
Well, I mean, if you just think about that idea, the idea of American exceptionalism, that means there's an us and a them.
Absolutely it does. And you know, the idea, I love these conversations. They come all too seldom, Scott. You're all wrapped up, you and Linda out there cooking dinner that I'm ruining, you know.
Oh, we got to talk about this. Okay, so you, the other day you were saying, oh, you know, we got people cooking dinner. You can't be going there, right?
Yeah.
we have very strong stomachs. You do just let the calls go whatever direction they go. We're all good, you know. I get a kick out of that, but it's like, really, no, let them go.
Well, you know, I've got this visual of you and Linda there, you know, slicing the vegetables and, you know.
Well, that's what Linda's doing right now, actually, so.
Well, okay, see, I was right.
So you've got it dead on, yep.
And it makes me very happy to know that, to be quite honest. It gives me joy. But going back to what I was going to say is that, you know, we can narrow this down to wasps. Because that idea of American exceptionalism is American Anglo, you know, Anglo exceptionalism.
Sure.
And of course, you know, the irony is not lost on me that the person who hollers American exceptionalism the most is a guy whose last name is Hannity.
Mm-hmm.
And whose idea of American exceptionalism is to set up a dummy charity, that he uses to fly himself around on Learjets.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing is that you know, you've got Sarah Palin out there saying, you know, there are parts of the country that are the real America, right? That's clearly an us and them thing, right? I don't know who these other people are. And that was my point in the locker room. It's like, you know, you understand what you're saying. You're saying that there's like 50-some-odd% of the people in this country that you don't think belong here. You know, the life would be much better if these people just didn't exist. Let's line them up and shoot them. I thought, wow, holy cow, this is Massachusetts. What's up with that? Right? And let me just say, I mean, this is an older white guy, right? I mean, I'm sure it didn't really cross his mind how, I don't know, incendiary that was to me to hear him say that. It's like, where'd that come from? You know, what are you so angry about? And that's, I think, you know, this idea, I think it's just an interesting lens to look at it through, because you come to see it's not just rich Americans together. You know, it's beyond that, I think. And I think it's true, right? Times are hard now, right? And I can tell you, it's not.
Yeah, we're celebrating. We're celebrating that we didn't lose more jobs again.
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, I mean, it's the average person is like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, and a lot of people realize they're never going to get that old job back, ever.
Well, the old job's gone.
Yeah.
And you know what? This topic has the potential, Scott, to be so far ranging and so in depth that we might never touch the bottom of it. But I return to my previous theme, and that is that this division is a created division. And the us and the them goes back to 1860.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll add one other thing. During the last period of massive economic agony, the Great Depression, there was something going on. There was a different dynamic, I suppose, because everybody was in the soup lines, and everybody was experiencing some degree of agony or another. And what's more, while there was radio, everybody didn't have one. And even to do something like listening to radio, you had to engage in a communal group effort, if you will.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, we may be in economic agony, but the cable's still on.
Yeah, no kidding.
And as long as the cable is still on, that means that we can sit quietly in our homes without engaging in any sort of community behavior, and be quiet and isolated in our agony. And that makes it that's like some sort of a multiplier, if you will. So you know, there's that line from John Sayles' great movie 1985 or 6, Mate One, where it says, all we got in common is our misery, so the least we can do is share it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was, you know, that was the attitude of Depression era America. We were in a common misery. Well, you know what? The misery is common here, too. And, you know, sure, back during the Depression, there were still people who were having lobster lunches. That never went completely away.
Right.
There were people who were still very, very wealthy. You know, you'll notice the Rockefellers made it through the Depression, right?
Right.
But as a consequence of the need to feel something, the need to come together, we got through it. whereas right now there is nothing to pull the country together. And the one thing that Barack Obama has not done is anything approaching the fireside chat, anything approaching a we're all, and maybe it's because he recognizes that by even attempting to do that, he would divide us further, because that would further inflame inflame the Confederates. And maybe instead of these or them or those people, maybe that's just the word we use, Scott. Maybe it's just the Confederates.
Yeah, it's fair enough to identify people, right, rather than just blindly categorizing them. This is the other thing we haven't talked. We haven't talked since the election, I don't think, right? So there's a lot to criticize, right? I mean, offshore oil drilling. My favorite thing about offshore oil drilling, by the way, is the government is now going to allow offshore oil drilling. That's like a government takeover. Like total socialism. What do you mean?
Hey, wait a minute. You're right.
Right? I love it, right? This is my new thing. Every time the government does something that's pro-capitalism, I say, that's like a government takeover of the oil drilling. That's what, God, that's socialism, right? These people are just, like, ridiculous.
Oh, and I got to share one with you. I ran across, I've been on a, for about 2-3 weeks now, I've been on a Vonnegut reading binge.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And I found one that I absolutely fell in love with from God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, and that's my signature to my email now. But I ran across another one in Hocus Pocus, which is a book that isn't talked about nearly as much as some of the others, but is equally brilliant. And it's a line that he ascribes to his grandfather, the socialist, who said, capitalism is whatever the people, drunk or sober, sane or capitalism is whatever the people who have our money, drunk or sober, sane or insane, happen to be doing with it today. And I've sort of held that thing out in my hand like a crystal and spun it around and rolled it over on its side and laid it end on, rolled it over end over. And I can't see where that definition is flawed.
No. But yeah, that's the way it is, right? I mean, this is the thing. I don't know. Maybe you get to a point where you just sort of, you look at the whole thing kind of like a freak show, right? I mean, you're in the fight, but sometimes you have to sort of stand back and look at it, right? And just to say, you know, wow, this is pretty bizarre, pretty abstract. And I think that, I love statements like that. Not to get back to the law geek stuff, but it's like, the law is whatever the last court said it was. Right? Everyone wants to set their hair on fire. Well, oh, that's a wrong decision, blah, 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 right? It doesn't matter. You know, that's not the way the thing really works. The law is whatever the last court said it was.
Yeah, if
it disturbs people so much, but that's the way it is, you know?
It absolutely is the way it is. The only question, you know, there are issues of ethics. And there are issues of jurisprudence involved. But yeah, the law is all, you know, the law is an ass. We all know that one. We all know, you know, it's always somebody, you know, it depends on whose ox is getting gored. We know that
exactly.
One.
Exactly. Yep. Yep.
But we also, you know, there's something out there in us that recognizes, when the court seems to have taken, there's that veil again, taken the veil off and just said, no, this is how we are. And that's what the Citizens United decision is.
Well, that's a perfect example, right? So it's like when Roberts got all upset that Obama called him out during the State of the Union, called the Supreme Court out during the State of the Union, and he said afterwards, "Well, you know, to be sitting there in a political body being criticized when we were sort of unable to respond, and really, you know, our work is not political. It's whatever. We were not in a position to respond." That's just a fantasy. The Supreme Court's totally a political body. Otherwise, no one would care about confirmation hearings at all. It's because everyone understands that the Supreme Court's also a political body. That we, you know, the judicial branch isn't this independent third thing. We know that.
And there's nothing in the Constitution that establishes a merit test for a seat on the Supreme Court. And as long as the president is the one doing the appointing, you know, hell, it would be the same if it was the Senate or the House doing the appointing, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yep.
Because nobody, for the most part, over the history of the court, nobody is appointed because they are exclusively a brilliant jurist. If that was the case, Lawrence Tribe would have been on the Supreme Court 30 years ago. But but he's not there.
No, no. People are appointed or nominated or whatever because they're going to get the right answer, right? I mean, that's fair.
And you know that applies
to the political branch,
and that applies to Earl Warren.
Yeah, exactly.
And it applies to Brennan.
Yep, totally symmetrical argument. Whether you're a liberal or a conservative.
Yeah.
And don't tell judicial action.
Hey, who appointed Whizzer White?
Whatever the court's doing.
Who appointed Whizzer White?
Okay, now you're getting out of my depth.
Well, I mean that's the point. It's a symmetrical argument because John Kennedy appointed Whizzer White, and that guy did everything short of going to work with a swastika on his arm. You know, a horrible, horrible conservative.
Yeah.
And wasn't expected to be that way. You know, there are a few exceptions to the rule, and I think Thurgood Marshall was one. Thurgood Marshall had to be who Thurgood Marshall was. Only Nixon could go to China, and only Thurgood Marshall could be Thurgood Marshall. But anybody who thinks, for instance, that Ronald Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor because he needed a woman on the court, no. He appointed Sandra Day O'Connor because he needed a woman on the court that he thought he could count on to rule with him most of the time.
Right.
And you know what? Bush v. Gore proves that he was right. You know, everybody wants to, and I'm as bad as the next one about hollering about the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia.
Yeah.
But if you want to come right down to it, if anyone has ever earned the disdain of anybody who cares about the whatever passes for democracy in this country, the disdain has been wholly earned by Sandra Day O'Connor, and I don't care if she was a woman, a man, or a Martian. She played pure politics as she was expected to do. And I don't care how many sentences there are in that decision that says this is a one-off and can never be used as precedent. You know what? There's no guarantee that some court down the road won't look at it and say, well, they said that, but they didn't understand these facts, and therefore that's what we're going to rely on.
Right. So let me make you veer one more time.
Okay. I can do that.
One other thing that you've been, so we've touched this thing, right? Which I think you're right is very deep, but I think after Lynn and I had this conversation, I think if you look at it through that lens, a lot of it makes sense, and a lot of it sort of comes home to be something actually fairly simple and easy to understand. Of course, a lot more complicated, but I mean, I think that there's that current underneath it. But let me ask you, because you've been talking about this a lot, and every time you talk about it, I'm like, oh God, I gotta call him. Let's talk about cap and trade.
Do let's.
Okay, so let's do, okay? Because this is something I went to law school to get involved in environmental law and, you know, sort of law and economics and so forth. So tell me what's the rap about cap and trade? Why is it, give me the overview, because I've been hearing a lot of things, you know, on the show about, you know, it's a sham, blah, 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 blah. It's a boondoggle. So tell me where you're coming from on that.
Well, first of all, it's not, if we can isolate, Scott, the idea of cap and trade from what cap and trade is being encapsulated in.
Okay, good. Let's do that.
And that is the fact that while we ought to be talking about solutions to the carbon problem, which the science is not unclear on, which the science is rock solid on, and the idea of the tipping point and all of that stuff, it absolutely dictates that we do something about carbon. And, you know, just because China or India isn't doing something about it doesn't mean we don't have to either, because what's the old number, Scott? We have a third of the, we have 4% of the world's population. We consume 25% of its resources. That
right,
kind of puts
right.
a moral obligation on us to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Moral leadership, yeah. Not to mention the fact that it's going to be the economy of the future.
Well,
strictly self-interested sense, right?
And so, having said that, it's the fact that the bill that contains cap and trade contains a whole bunch of stuff that basically neuters, even assuming cap and trade works as it is designed to work, neuters cap and trade from being effective.
Okay.
You know, the coal welfare that's in there, you know, I've seen estimates running anywhere from $60 billion to $280 billion.
Right, but that's not a critique of cap and trade.
No, that is not a critique of cap and trade, but they've got this they've made this fossil fuel welfare a condition precedent to even thinking about cap and trade.
Of course they have. Yeah. Of course they did. Yep.
Now, as far as cap and trade itself is concerned, it's the question of A, will it, as Matt Taibbi complained, will it set up yet another bubble market? And two, should we be talking, and this is the memo that was written by those two San Francisco EPA lawyers who basically were pilloried for it, not cap and trade, but cap and tax.
Okay, so explain the cap and tax one to me, because here's how I understand it. So this is my, you know, very sort of rudimentary understanding of it. But that the difference between taxing and a cap and trade is, and you know, we're not going to get many of these things right, but if you set a 3% tax on carbon, or a, you know, 10 cent per ton or whatever, $10 per ton, whatever it turns out to be, right? Some tax that makes it painful to use carbon. It's going to be hard for you to figure out how to adjust that tax to actually get the amount of carbon use you actually want. Right? So you got to dial that tax up into the point where it's painful enough that people actually stop using carbon. Like cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
There's a small number of people that are actually dissuaded by the cost of a pack of cigarettes. And the more expensive you make it, some more people peel off and say, I can't afford it anymore. Right? But it's always hard to know
what that level is.
That should be, right? So
yes.
If you say, what you do know is, you have some idea of what targets we need to reach in terms of like what percentage of 1990 emissions is going to allow the atmosphere to return to normal over a period of 100 years or something. You do have some idea of what that level ought to be. And so if you know what the level ought to be, that's the idea behind the cap. Right.
Right? And so I don't know if anybody... I don't know of anybody inside the environmental community that doesn't agree with the cap end of it, whether it's cap and trade, cap and tax. I've got a ball cap from the Environmental Defense Fund it's a red cap, white letters, says just cap it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing to remember is cap and trade is an idea originally proposed by the economists for the sulfur program. For the acid rain program.
Right, exactly.
This is a conservative idea.
Right, it was manifested in the swaps that apparently the right wing didn't have any problems with. The Bush administration put them in there, and this was part of what the Bush administration ballyhooed as voluntary oversight or corporate self oversight.
That was exactly that.
So that if you had for instance an old filthy coal-fired power plant that was pumping out tons of sulfur, they would buy credits from a plant that was newer that wasn't.
Well, that's not corporate oversight. I mean that's part of the EPA Clean Air Act. I mean, the absolutely the law of the land.
But they tried to do the
what do they call it? The Clean Skies Initiative.
Yeah, Clear Skies, yes.
Clear Skies, right? Yeah. So the Bush administration tried to do what you would expect, which is they tried to do this thing which totally corrupted the basic idea of cap and trade. Right,
but it was going to be entirely voluntary.
Exactly, and you could bundle things together into huge conglomerates and trade within the conglomerate to the point where there'd be essentially no you pull the teeth out of the law, basically.
Right, it would devolve into entropy almost instantaneously.
Exactly, but I mean, let's think about what the sulfur program has done. The sulfur program has raised the cost of high sulfur coal relative to low sulfur coal.
Absolutely. Jeff Biggers noted that as being one of the reasons that the coal market collapsed in southeast Illinois.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That was a great conversation, by the way. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, he's such a great guy. I mean, he is every bit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as genuine as he sounds on the air.
Yeah, no, it's just so deep in the history and the ramifications of it. Really excellent. But if it's just, if you... here's the way I look at it, and we can figure out what's wrong with it, but I think that the idea of cap and trade, so some of the things people say is cap and trade gives people pollution allowances, right?
Right.
It gives them the right to pollute, right? And that they're sort of annoyed by the concept that a carbon credit or carbon allowance, emission allowance, would give someone the right to pollute. Okay, now there's a subtle point. Right now, every coal-fired power plant has an unlimited right to pollute for free.
Yes.
Under a cap-and-trade regime, you have a right to pollute that you have to buy on the market. Right? It's no longer free. It's like saying, it becomes a property right, right? It's like saying, I have the right to live in my home because I purchased my home.
But you still have to pay your property taxes.
Exactly, and I still have to pay for that, right? So I think that's, this idea that it's a repugnant idea because what you're doing is selling the right to pollute, I think is just wrong because right now you're giving away the right to pollute.
Yes. 100% true, and I guess the simplest analogy we could come up with is and it was far more sustainable. Remember the days of the deposit bottle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean that was not the law of the land, but that was just how it all worked. You know, you went and you bought six bottles of Coca-Cola, and they came in thick glass bottles, and you saved them, and when you were done, you took them back to the store. You got a credit for your bottles against your next purchase of Coca-Cola.
We still have that day, right? You still have deposits, don't you?
No.
Oh, we do, big time.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it went away and it came back.
Mm-hmm.
I see cap and trade a little bit along those lines. And you might be interested to know that I've had some conversations in D.C. with some folks who, suffice to say an interesting conversation considering who was making the point. And I was making the argument for an Appalachian Renaissance. And bringing, breaking the stranglehold of the coal mono economy here before it breaks us.
Right.
And what I was told is, well, listen, if that's how you feel, then it's very unlikely that you're going to see stimulus money because it just ain't going to happen. Secondly, if you want to see what you're talking about with big money being poured by the government into Appalachia, then the monies made on the cap and trade market are where those monies are going to come from.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's total. I mean, of course, I'm not saying it's going to happen that way. But this is something I care a lot about, and I want to make sure we say some of the right things about it. Because, so what happened when when Europe did cap and trade? So people are going to say cap and trade is a boondoggle, because what Europe did is Europe gave away the allowances based on the power company's prior use of carbon. So they said, if your average use over the preceding 3 years, and this is actually how our sulfur program used to work, if your average carbon production over the previous 3 years averaged to be a billion pounds or whatever, billion tons, we're going to give you credits for a billion tons. Actually, that's not right. That's not right. Let's say... there's three companies, each one of them produce the same amount of energy, right? Same amount of carbon. Then what they're going to say is, here's the cap. The cap is 100. We're going to give you 33 credits, you 33 credits, and you 33 credits, okay, based on the fact that you've all previously used a similar amount. So what that did is they knew that was coming, and that gamed the system. What they all did is they all cranked up their carbon output. Like, well, wait a minute. We used 50% of the carbon last year, so we should get 50% of the credits. They gamed the system because the government gave them the credits. Now, I hope what's being proposed now, and it's well recognized as a flaw, is that the credits, you say, look, there's 100 credits on offer, and we're going to have an auction. And I don't care how many you used last year. If you used 50 last year, you better pony up and buy 50, or you're out of luck, right? Maybe you're only going to get 40, and you're going to have to buy the other 10 off somebody else. And the reason that's important is what it does is it raises the cost of coal. It raises the cost of high carbon sources relative to low carbon sources.
Right, coal as opposed to, say, windmills.
Exactly. Coal as opposed to natural gas. Natural gas as opposed to windmills, right? So it creates a drag, an economic drag. You know, everyone says, well, you know, the problem is that solar's too expensive. Well, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is the problem with coal is that coal is too cheap.
Too artificially cheap, and we've talked about that a million times because the cost of coal, the true cost of coal is externalized onto the general population.
Exactly. So this is at least one attempt to internalize the cost of coal, right, to drive the price up of these other things, of these other sources, so that the other sources of energy become cost competitive. Right. Now, what people are going to say, of course, the conservatives are going to say is, that's going to increase my energy costs. And guess what? That's true.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
If you want to internalize costs, it's damn well going to increase your costs. And guess what that's going to make you do? It's going to make you put up windmills instead of coal plants, which is exactly what you want to do. You want to have the government incentive structure a market to tip the market in the direction of the outcome you want. And I think cap and trade, if it's done right, does that.
Well, within the scope of all this, I just got an email in from our buddy Ron in Raleigh.
Yeah.
And he said, and I think you've touched on some of what he's put forward. And he says the problem with cap and trade is that the carbon credits are going to be given away and not sold. If that's the case, there's no incentive to reduce carbon emissions, plus the entire program will become another Wall Street boondoggle.
Exactly.
And then finally, another thing is, who will monitor the trades? You know, and that last one I find particularly interesting, Scott, because it's a question, for instance, should the Department of Energy monitor the trades, or do the auctions, frankly? Or should it be the EPA?
Well, the EPA, I think the EPA monitors the auctions right now of sulfur, for sulfur. So that's done under EPA. It's clearly true that if they're given away, it's pointless. But I think that, and that's also what led to the bubble in Europe, right? What burst the bubble in Europe was the fact that they were being given away, and so the value got cut out because you just had to wait a year and you'd get a whole fresh bunch for free. And so no one had an advantage. I mean, well, we talked about doing it. The environmental law group at the law school were talking about buying up sulfur credits and retiring them, not selling them to anybody.
And another thing rolling along here, News Ninja Gene just provided this to me, and this is I think where so much of the misgiving comes from, Scott. Maybe not so much with the structural idea or the baseline idea of it, but what we know will happen to it when the wrong people get hold of it.
Okay, that's great. Right.
And the question is, who is Blythe Masters? And Blythe Masters, if this article is to be taken at face value, is the J.P. Morgan employee who invented credit default swaps.
Mm-hmm.
And Blythe Masters is now heading J.P. Morgan's carbon trading efforts.
Uh-huh.
40-year-old who oversees the bank's environmental businesses as the firm's global head of commodities.
Mm-hmm.
And invented the credit default swap, and we all know where that took us.
Right.
And I think that's what leads a lot of people to think that cap and trade is going to wind up being a boondoggle. Because not because the idea is bad, but because the people who will, it is a human institution, and you know, water seeks its own level, so to speak.
Yeah, but I mean, I totally agree with that. I totally understand that. But it's not to throw up our hands and say, oh my God, people are corrupt, right? I mean, we got to do something. And I think that
it's that versus the condemned ate heartily. There's always a dinner reference here, Scott.
I agree. We're probably not going to get it right because there's a whole bunch of wiggle room in there, right? We haven't even talked about the cap.
We haven't talked about what the cap's going to be.
Yeah,
and even that is causing, And frankly, I think it would be wise within this discussion, and it should probably be continued on another program or some such. But one of the, there's also a divergence of opinion between the so-called big greens and the people that I run around with, the people who live the reality, the grassroots. You either watched or listened to the Kennedy Blankenship debate, did you not?
No.
Oh, darn. Well, at the end of that, Don Blankenship and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. were called upon by the moderator, Dr. Welch, to find something upon which they can agree.
Okay.
And Don Blankenship, you know, with his little pencil-thin porn mustache, and you know, God knows he hasn't seen his feet since he was 15. Sorry, I have to get that kind of sleazy name-calling stuff in there.
You've got to get the visual image in there.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, well, I think Mr. Kennedy, you know, he's one of them outside agitators and all. I think Mr. Kennedy and I can probably agree that geologic carbon sequestration is a big old boondoggle. And RFK on the other side said, absolutely.
Wow.
And meanwhile, and Bobby is general counsel for the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.
Yeah.
And I heard a bit of gossip somewhere along the way that somebody back at the office said, you know what? I guess we're going to have to go back and revise our CCS position since our general counsel just said it's a boondoggle.
Yeah, so we've
because they were for it.
No, we'll do two things. We'll do two things on that. One, carbon capture and sequestration is a great idea, right? If you could do it, right?
Right. Like, so is building a direct pipeline to the sun.
Exactly. It's an excellent idea. So I'm not against carbon capture and sequestration, right?
I'm not, any more than I'm against energy that is derived from the love emanating from sparkling purple unicorns.
Precisely, right? And as soon as someone can make a nuclear power plant that can power my watch, you know, I'll be like, okay, fine, that's great. What an amazing technological advance that was, right? But right now, you know, so this it's a bit of a lie, right? You can be in favor of carbon capture in the abstract, right? Knowing that there's, you know, that if you could do it, it would be a great idea. But what these guys are talking about it as though it's a reality, it's like an actual policy choice.
Right, and that's where that $60 to $280 billion in the bills that are out there banging around goes to.
Yeah. No, that's a sad thing.
When maybe there's $4 billion for alternative fuels research
and efficiency, much less for efficiency too, which is the
right
investment you can make in terms of energy production, right? But the other thing I'll say that I'm worried about, and this is going to bring us full circle, is okay. So let's say we drive the price of coal through the roof with some extremely well implemented cap and trade or cap and tax or whatever, right? It's still going to be completely legal, so far as I understand, for people to blow the tops off your mountains, bundle the stuff up, and ship it off to someone who doesn't have a cap and trade program. Right? Once it becomes too expensive to sell in this country, it's going to be sold somewhere else.
Well, exactly. The tobacco market is the case in point for that.
Right.
Because as soon as there was pressure on the cigarette market in the United States, American cigarette producers ramped up production in the most vulnerable, most susceptible to bad marketing practices countries in the world, and they're selling cigarettes hand over fist there.
Yep, and, you know, here comes China, right? Yeah. So the socialism piece about it, and I don't know how I feel about this, because, you know, you can tell from what I'm saying. I'm a market kind of guy, right? I think things should be for sale, and they should be sold to the person to whom they have the most value. And if you end up having to spend so much for your vice you decide to do something else, that's like a good thing, I think. But what I think is so interesting with the offshore drilling, right? People say, that's our oil. That's American oil, right? Like it's something we own together. Like like we live in a socialist country, and right. this is a national resource.
Like there's a $500 bill out there with an oil derrick in the portrait in the portrait frame. There
well,
isn't.
What I think is interesting about that, though, is that I think maybe that's right. I think maybe we need to say, you know what? If you dig up coal in this country, you're not allowed to sell it somewhere else because it's a natural resource of the United States.
Right.
Everyone says, and it's like totally anti-market. Right? It's totally, you know, Marxism. It's awful. It's just the worst thing, right? But it's, if you feel, everyone says, if we drill for oil in off the Gulf, in the Gulf of Mexico and off the eastern coast, that's going to drive our gas prices down. Now, we have no idea who those companies are actually going to sell that oil to.
Right.
It might not even be us.
Well, I don't think there's any might to it, Scott. Ain't going to be. At least we know.
Whoever offers the most.
The What's-Its Bay in Alaska that's going to get drilled, that ain't going to come here.
Yep. And this is such an interesting thing because people, if you look back in our history, people say, you know, we landed on the shores of America with the incredible richness of the natural resources. We are a great nation because we have natural resources in abundance.
Yeah, but even that is predicated on one of the worst lies, worst historic lies of all time, and that is that the shores of the continent were empty all the way to the interior.
Oh, the stuff wasn't owned. Yeah, that the people that were there weren't people.
Hey, Ma, look what we found.
Yeah. No, we did. We discovered it. It didn't exist before because white people didn't, you know, cognize it. That's.
And you know, with a nod of my head to all the commentary work that our good friend Joe Bagent has done, especially in Deer Hunting with Jesus. You know, there's the line is actually about the Scots landing in Ireland, but you can equally apply it to the Scots-Irish landing in the U.S. And that is, upon arriving here, they fell on their knees and prayed to God, and then fell on the locals and prayed on them.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you know, that brilliant.
Go the spoils, right? I mean, that's the sad and.
Well, no, to the burglar go the spoils.
Well, you know, Victor Burglar, whatever. You know,
right.
I mean, he who wins writes history, right? The one who writes history never calls it the burglar.
No,
why would you do that?
Right. And you know, the Howard Zinn touches on some of it in his People's History of the United States, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
But the best overall description of the Americas upon the arrival of the white folks is in Charles C. Mann's 1491. And it's absolutely breathtaking, because when you just stop for a moment to ponder. A pair of continents, or the entirety of a hemisphere, shall we say, that had more population than the entirety of the rest of the globe combined.
Mm-hmm.
And then you turn around and read about this vast expanse of wilderness that the white people found.
Right.
It makes the marbles rattle.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's how you know that the winners write history, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
And there was no one. Guess what? There was no one here. Have you seen that? This is going to be really bad. Have you seen that show, Bait Car?
No.
Oh, my God. It's so awful. It's like the worst reality. But what they basically do is they take an Escalade, and they drive it into some place where cars get stolen frequently, and they make it look totally fugitive. The doors are flung open. The people are in an argument. They drive off, right? And this car is left here with the keys in it. It's like running, right? And some poor idiot always gets into it, and the thing's got all these kinds of surveillance cameras in it and stuff, right? And the person drives it off, and it makes for great television because it's clear the guy's totally busted, and they shut the car down and pull him over, right? And they always say, no, the guy gave me the car. You know? It's the same thing. It's like, no, we got here, and there's like nobody here. You wouldn't believe it, you know?
Yeah, no, the Indians
all this
did
stuff, and like nobody, you know?
Yeah, they said they were moving on.
Yeah. They said they really didn't like it here. Yeah, they were going to move on and leave it to us. But I think just from the sort of socialist standpoint, right, we have this very interesting idea that these are our as a nation natural resources. And I think it's hard. I don't know how to deal with it because you know that's what's going to happen. Unfortunately, you know that if we raise the price of coal use in the United States will go down. and the coal will continue to be mined, and it will be sent somewhere else. I don't know how to solve that problem, but it's, you know, sort of like you push down on a balloon that comes up somewhere else.
Some of it can be done Blankenship doesn't, you know, Don just likes to do business with the Indians and the Chinese. He just does.
Right.
On the other hand, though, there's other stuff that we can do. A Russian company has bought mines in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
Do we, and I don't know the answer to this, Scott. Do we have Saudi companies drilling for oil in the U.S.?
Yeah, those oil leases, will they be given to a Saudi company?
Yeah, or a holding company that's British, that's owned by an intermediary, that's German, that's actually owned by the King of Saudi Arabia? No, that could never happen. Or, as I posited a couple of nights ago, what happens when it turns out that Hugo Chavez is drilling that?
Yeah, that's gonna make for a fun episode of Hannity.
I can't wait till the one where the episode where he and Oliver North's heads explode at the same time. That's the one I'm waiting for.
Yeah, now, it's been fascinating to see, you know, to see how so quickly things got so angry and so angry. Not much more to say than that.
And we haven't even touched on the letters to the governors.
Oh my God, yeah.
I don't know if my governor got one of those. I think the right wing's pretty happy with him right now. He's so pro coal and so forth. But did you happen to notice where it came from?
It came from a Dominionist group, didn't it?
Well, they call themselves Guardians of the Free Republics.
Yes, right.
But what they are is restorationist, because it's the restore America plan.
Yes.
And anytime
that's
I see, yeah, and you know, the Dominionists are actually the kinder, gentler as between them and the restorationists. Reconstructionists.
Yeah. Well, these guys want to return America to the Christian caliphate that it was at the founding.
Right. Yeah,
right. I mean, where it's a Christian nation. That's what these guys are about.
Yeah, that America that exists primarily in their own the odd little imaginations.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting times, but you do have to. I'll just say, you know, one thing is, I'm so happy we have a president that can put a complete sentence together.
Yeah, I'm still feeling good about that. And look, you know, I have to reevaluate things, and it's the. You know, it was Bismarck who coined the term realpolitik.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you have to constantly reevaluate your political positions, because nothing is static in politics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm frustrated with Obama and have been and probably will be again, because I am further to the left of him on the Overton window, and I'm dragging that little sucker, that Overton window to the left as quick as I can pull. it's a matter of, you know, there's not enough of us pulling it that way.
Yeah.
But so I'll be frustrated with him. But you know what? I already need, and I know I need it, here in April of 2010. I need 4 more years of Barack Obama. I really do.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, what's happening at the EPA is actually pretty good.
Yeah, how long would it take Caribou Barbie to undo what Lisa Jackson just announced yesterday?
Exactly. I mean, just think about the progress that's been made there. The Congress didn't have to do a thing, and that's what drives people crazy about the administrative state. It's the wonderful thing about it. The president has a tremendous amount of power just based on the way the laws get executed and which ones get enforced and which ones don't.
Exactly.
You know, the contrast couldn't be more stark between what the Bush administration did, and because they believed it to be true. Let's just give them all the, you know, let's say they were, you know, not being dishonest. They just don't think the world works that way. But what they did, as far as folks like us who think that things are interconnected and, you know, that externalities have costs, was a disaster. And the difference between what they did and what Obama's administration is doing, not a single law passed in Congress. Right, not to pass a law. EPA is going to regulate greenhouse gases all on its own.
And here's the fun part, the business you were talking about with the Supreme Court a little bit ago.
Yeah.
EPA is going to do it because the Supreme Court told them they had to.
Yeah. Isn't that great? I love that. That's my favorite part of it. Yeah.
Nope. You got to do it. I know you don't want to, but you got
to. Yeah. You ever going to force you to do it? Yeah. Because, you know, we kind of painted ourselves into a corner on that one, you know. Now it's so that's good. You know, that's good. I hope, the other thing I hope is, you know, the healthcare thing has been difficult. I hope they get onto jobs. You know, because everyone cares about that. You know, it's the economy, stupid, right? That's true. It was true then. It's true now.
And the thing is, you can't get. I don't see how you get onto the jobs issue in any wise meaningfully, Scott, without getting onto the green economy issue.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I get a lot of press releases for the Alliance for American Manufacturing, and there's a lot of smart people there.
Yeah.
And you know, they make good points. You know, the steel we make in the United States is done more cleanly and more greenly than anything that gets done in China.
Right, sure.
There is a net environmental gain, and I'm proud of them for recognizing the nexus of the two issues as well. There's a net environmental gain to be had by rebuilding America's manufacturing infrastructure with a sensible regulatory scheme around it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the reason that the manufacturing went overseas, was to avoid regulation.
Sure.
Right? And you know, all kinds of regulation, labor regulation, environmental regulation, right? So, yeah, that's I think that's totally true. But, of course, you've got this thing called the WTO, which doesn't allow you, I don't think, to say, well, you know what, we're going to charge a carbon tax for imports coming into this country. And so you're going to have to tell me how much carbon it took to make that girder of steel. And we'll compare that to the amount that it took in this country. We're going to charge you a carbon tax for it to drive its price up. And I don't think you're actually allowed to do that under the WTO, the current WTO. And I think that's a disaster. It's a recipe for disaster. It's a race to the bottom, you know, the classic race to the bottom.
Yeah, and a shameless one at that. Scott, this has been a wonderful conversation, my friend. I'm so glad you called in. And
yeah,
it's just a shame you couldn't go see the truckers tonight.
Well, I had something important to do, you know. I had been meaning to call you, you know. I've been like, you know, it's been too long, and there's just so many things I want to talk about, so.
Well, make sure you keep the list, because we always have fun when you do.
Yeah. All right, so, you know, hang in there, right? It's tough, but I think we're in a much better place now than we were before. But I'll tell you what, if you look at Massachusetts, you got to realize it's not as different as it might appear. I can tell you that.
No.
I go to the YMCA, and I can tell you.
Yeah,
it's a lot more like the rest of the country than you think.
And the militia wasn't arrested in Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. It was arrested in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana.
Yep.
Bears are remembering. All right, well, Scott, please give our kind regards to Linda, and enjoy dinner.
I will do that. She's probably just getting finished right now.
Okay, good deal. Take care.
All right. Okay, take care. Right.
Bye now. It's our buddy Scott calling from Massachusetts, and let's roll this thing onward. Let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, well, you know, while you were repeating the Bible verses on Easter, here's
yes.
an amazing thing that dropped on AP. Ratzinger's personal priest, during the Good Friday Mass, decided to compare, get this, the criticism that Ratzinger's been going under to anti-Semitism.
Yep, 6 million dead Jews is just like criticizing the Pope.
Yep, and of course, all just about anybody that's even close to being related to it is like, what?
Yeah, that's one of those oh no he didn't moments.
Yeah, and the church is immediately like, well, he wasn't.
Right? No, that's not what he said. He's anything. Yeah, it's the same answer the right wing always gives. He was taken out of context.
No, it wasn't. He was taken out of context. He wasn't speaking as an official spokesman of the church.
Yeah, that's why he was giving a sermon.
But here's the best part. Yeah, not only that, but here's the thing. It was put in the... it was put in their newspaper word for word.
Oh, the Vatican Observer, right under Father Guido Sarducci's column.
Yeah, they put the whole thing, including the offensive part.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, without a doubt, I keep thinking I've lost the ability to be shocked, but even this, I just looked at looking for that onion address.
I was like, I grabbed for the phone as soon as I saw that, and on the AP news feed, I was like, oh my god, like, you know, especially since you were in the middle of doing the whole Easter zombie Jesus thing.
Well, now, see, that's the thing. I left out the zombie part.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm looking at the AP story now. As the Pope listened in a hushed St. Peter's Basilica, you can just hear all the gasps. The Reverend Raniero Cantalamessa likened accusations against the pontiff and the Catholic Church in sex abuse scandals in Europe, the U.S., and elsewhere to the collective violence suffered by the Jews. Now, well, without quite getting around to mentioning that a whole bunch of that collective violence was performed by the Church, but, you know, who's counting? Because, it's not just the Holocaust. Further. There are these ugly little things called pogroms. And,
pogroms?
You know, yeah, they went on for basically, 2,000 years. The Church was behind things like Jews kidnap Christian babies and make their matzah with their blood. It's called the blood libel. The Church said that Jews were causing the Black Death because they had poisoned Christian wells because Christians seemed to be dying but Jews weren't. That's because Jews were 900 million times more cleanly than the dirty, filthy Christians were.
Yes, they knew how to wipe their butts and throw out their trash. Probably.
And wash their hands.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine that? Because, hand washing got a bad rap from Pontius Pilate. I wash my hands of this. Let it be on their heads. Yes, let it be on our heads. You know, that whole... Right.
Yeah.
And so hand washing took a bad rap in Europe at the hands of the Church for, a couple of thousand years.
Yeah, and it's funny, and it's nowadays, modern day Christians, modern day Christian Americans use that as a reason to rip the French.
Here's the real funsy out of the whole story, though, Garrett. Instead of saying these were his own ideas, Father Cantalamessa used the fox strategy. He said in his sermon that he got the idea from this friend of mine who's a Jew, who he said wrote him a letter saying, and he said, Jews, quote, know from experience what it means to be the victims of collective violence, and also because of this they are quick to recognize the recurring symptoms. He put it, he wouldn't even own up to the idea himself and instead put it off on the Jews as if, whoever the anonymous Jewish friend was would say, yes, let it be on our heads. Again,
yeah, it's,
some more.
Yeah, but it's like his Jewish friend is like Stephen Colbert's black friend and Stephen
yes,
Colbert,
yes,
yes. I don't know, it's like even if they do exist, the picture of Colbert standing there smiling greatly is next to this person of color who's just like, God, I want to slug you. Because the best part in the whole version of the article I read was where the German Jewish official, you can tell he's like absolutely PO'd beyond compare over this comparison.
So is the American gathering of Holocaust survivors.
Ilan
Steinberg said, shame on Father Cantalamessa. I'm going to have a hard time saying his name without saying Father Cantaloupe. The Vatican is entitled to defend itself, but the comparison with anti-Semitic persecution is offensive and unsustainable. We are sorely disappointed, and they did it to us, too. No, he didn't say that last part, but he darn sure should have.
Yeah. And the American Jewish Committee, yeah.
It's kind of like having Sean Hannity quote Juan Williams on Fox.
Yeah.
Yeah, or Father Cannelloni. That's a good one. How can they? Well, so much for infallibility.
But this quote by the German Jewish leader, Stefan Kramer, it's the one that's really just lays down. He says it is repulsive, obscene, and most of all offensive toward all abusive victims as well as to all the victims of the Holocaust, said Kramer, General Secretary of Germany's Central Council of Jews.
And he's not exactly wrong, is he?
No, he's not. And I mean, you know, I mean, he says it in probably the harshest terms that any of these officials would be able to, because I mean, there's a point where you can't say it, even though you'd like him to say it. It's just not going to happen. But because the first sentence here in this article says describe the remarks as unheard of insolence.
And you know, they still haven't quite gotten around to what was his name, Father Rubio. You know, they're still dealing with Milwaukee and Munich. They haven't got, what is this, the 3M sex abuse thing? Munich, Milwaukee, and Miami. They haven't even gotten around to Father Rubio.
Yeah.
What we're dealing with, and I think this is appropriate since Clash of the Titans has opened. What we're dealing with, what the church is dealing with here, is a hydra. Every time they think they've cut the head off, cut the head off of it, it grows 3 back in its place.
Yes.
And it's going to continue to do that until the church realizes that it's trying to treat a symptom and not the disease itself. And the disease is the church's misogyny. The disease is the church's homophobia. The disease is the church's sense of infallibility. Wow. The disease is the church.
Pretty much. I mean, that's what Malloy's been saying and through this whole particular scandal and other ones, and it's true. This has been... I mean, this was a joke. God, I think. I mean, how long has this been going on? It's nearly 2 decades that these scandals have been popping up now, when you think about it. I mean, the first ones that I remember was like 93 or 94. I can't remember which one, but I know that's when it started.
Yeah, those are the ones that bobbed to the surface. But then that was an. And notice, you know, we don't get the Irish Church. Where did that word go? We don't get the facts about what went on in the Irish Church from the church. We got it because the Irish government studied, unless I recall incorrectly. We don't get the revelations about Milwaukee because the church studied it. We get it because a man finally spoke out. Same thing with Munich. And buried in under all of this is the fact that the brother of the Pope was, okay, granted, he wasn't buggering little boys. He was beating them. And, you know, and I guess the horror is so great that it's somehow, there's a degree of relativism involved where, you know, hey, look, he was only hitting them. He wasn't banging them. You know, we'll deal with that on the day off. After we're done not dealing with this.
Yeah, it's so.
And that's what it is. We'll not deal with that later after we're done not dealing with this.
Yeah. Well, they keep, because the whole church would have to be completely leveled in order. I mean, the entire Vatican power structure would have to all, you know, disappear, essentially, for you to even get the problem. Because, as we've learned, Ratzinger was right in the middle of covering it up.
Yeah, the thick of things.
Yeah. I mean, and at this point, it's starting to get to the point to where there's going to be one scandal that pops up that just is so bad that it just completely turns everybody off. I mean, everybody is slowly but surely getting turned off on the church as it is, but there's going to be a tipping point. There has to be. It's getting worse than, I mean, Bill Clinton didn't even have this much trouble with the bimbo.
Yeah, if only Bill had been Pope.
If Bill had been Pope,
there'd been 2,000 years of philandering history behind him saying, this is okay. No big deal.
Well, no, he would have been, he still would have been thrown out because he would have been having sex with adult women. Apparently.
Oh, with that, Garrett, I'm going to roll on. That's
a Yeah, I know. I think I crossed a line.
No, you didn't cross a line. That was just too. You let the joke end on the good punchline.
Yeah.
Have a good weekend. Take care, Garrett.
Yeah. Go Mountaineers.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely.
Yes.
Later. Bye now.
Bye.
And if you're on hold, please stay that way. We're going to take a little break and come back. We didn't get to last night's Green News Report, so we will this time through. And we're going to continue the music theme as well. A little Leon Russell coming your way, courtesy of David in Tennessee. Might be the Prince of Peace returning. Worth your consideration. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, it's 304-658-3333, and we will get right back to the phones as soon as we get back. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Oh! Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, March 30th, 2010.
China beats the U.S. again. EPA vetoes mountaintop removal. The right-wing response to Earth Hour. Plus, Sarah Palin spends her weekend recycling.
We do need to drill here and drill now.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Now, media, try to get this right, okay?
Hey, Sarah, how's that whole hopey screechy thing working for you? This is your Green News Report.
Okay?
Today's Green News Report is brought to you by StopDomesticTerror.com. The passage of health insurance reform has once again led to a rapid increase in domestic terrorist threats, this time against Democratic officials. Velvet Revolution has been calling on the DOJ for months to crack down on those who would incite this kind of violence. Please sign on and support VR's important StopDomesticTerror.com campaign today before it's too late. That's StopDomesticTerror.com. Okay, Des, hope you enjoyed Earth Hour this weekend. Did you turn off your lights?
Yes, certainly did.
Yes, actually, we did. We had a lovely candlelight game of Scrabble.
It was fun.
Who won?
You did.
Thank you for pointing that out. What are the green headlines, Des?
Well, Earth Hour was on Saturday night when people in countries all around the world turned off their electric lights for 1 hour.
And played Scrabble. And who won?
You did.
Thank you.
In a global call for action on climate change. The organizers at EarthHour.org say it was a great success with hundreds of millions of people participating in 125 countries around the world. But you'll probably not be surprised that some folks didn't like the idea. Specifically, the very mature folks at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian think tank, who put out a counter call instead to turn on all your lights to celebrate what they called Human Achievement Hour, to show our appreciation that we can turn on our lights whenever we want.
Did they really?
Yes, they did.
Oh, brother.
It seems the real high-minded purpose behind it was just to tick off liberals by wasting as much energy as possible.
These guys are geniuses.
You can check out all the awesome photos from all around the world at earthhour.org. It's really cool. The Sphinx and the pyramids look really weird when they're all dark like that. China surpasses the U.S. in clean energy investment.
China wants those jobs. Germany wants those jobs. They are going after them hard, making the investments required.
President Obama wasn't kidding when he said that in a town hall meeting back in January. And now a new study shows that China, for the first time, has surpassed the U.S. and is now the leader in clean energy investment in the world. China spent $34 billion last year, nearly twice what the U.S. spent. The comprehensive study from the Pew Charitable Trusts says the U.S. has slipped behind 10 countries, including Canada and Mexico, in spending on clean energy as a share of the national economy. A Los Angeles Times analysis says the Pew report raises questions about American competitiveness in a global market both now and in the future. And in a related story, although China has taken the lead in clean energy investment in the world, they still rely heavily on polluting fossil fuels like coal. And at this hour, rescuers in northern China are attempting to reach 153 coal miners trapped in a flooded coal mine. China's mines are the most deadly in the world, with over 2,600 deaths in Chinese mining accidents last year alone.
How many?
2,600.
2,600 deaths in China
one
in 1 year in coal mining accidents?
Yes.
Good Lord.
West Virginia Coal gonna take you on a ride.
The Environmental Protection Agency takes another whack at mountaintop removal coal mining.
About time.
The West Virginia Gazette reports that the EPA is proposing a veto of the strip mining permit of one of West Virginia's largest strip mines, using its authority under the Clean Water Act. In its report, the EPA says the controversial Spruce No. 1 mine would cause, quote, unacceptable adverse impacts that would be, quote, irreversible, including burying of miles of streams and adverse health impacts on residents living near the mine.
For folks who aren't clear on this, mountaintop removal is blowing off the tops of mountains. That's it. It is irreversible, and it's about time the EPA steps in and says no, finally, no.
Well, the veto proposal is only the next step in a long formal process that could take a year or more, but it will include an opportunity for the public to weigh in on the mine. The public comment period on this is crucial. Speaking up will make a difference in the EPA's final decision, and we have the links at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
And this is the first veto for this sort of thing, is it not?
Yes,
ever.
Yes, it is. And did we mention that the West Virginia State Chapter of the Chamber of Commerce is working hard to curtail disability benefits for coal miners suffering from black lung disease?
Of course they are.
You bastards!
And finally, Sarah Palin spent her weekend recycling at a Tea Party rally in Searchlight, Nevada. Former Republican vice presidential candidate and half-term Alaska governor Sarah Palin recycled all the old campaign slogans and conventional energy policies from the 2008 election.
Like this one?
We do need to drill here and drill now.
She was attacking Democrats for trying to develop a clean energy economy.
And we need to jumpstart energy projects because Congress and those in the White House choose to not allow us to develop our own God-given resources in the United States of America.
She's talking about our God-given resources in the middle of the Nevada desert this weekend, not once talking about that great big giant glowing orb above her head and the free energy resources that are raining down on her. She's a genius, and my ears are still bleeding. For much more on that, check out our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Okay.
Gonna get along without you now. Gonna get along without
you. This is a public service announcement.
There's a new type of music program coming to the horn.
Got a letter from the government the other day. Opened it and read it. It said they were suckers.
They wanted me about a summer or whatever. Picture me buying the scam. I said never.
But I don't need the battle call.
Music for liberals. Music for activists. Music with a social conscience.
Keep me down, Kate.
The People's Mixtape.
Johnny's dead, Adventure's gone, and Kelly have to lose that on the list of dead goes about an ongoing death.
Coming soon to the Head On Radio Network.
Now, Paul, Paul, now.
Cut your flag, the gal won't get you into heaven anymore.
Wake up, wake up.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
At 7.5 minutes past the hour, it certainly is me. And I'm so glad it's you, too. A couple of emails before we run back to the phones, assuming there's anybody still there, which I hope there is. Or might be. At any rate, this in from Clayton. Clayton says, last night I went to a celebration of the Health Insurance Reform Act with Mary Jo Kilroy and Senator Sherrod Brown. So I missed the horn. Well, at night I listened to my iPhone radio on iTunes. I awoke at 3:30 a.m. hearing your voice reporting that Senator Sherrod Brown had signed S-696. Then you reported that the EPA is using science again. The end of days is surely upon us. I went into my backyard at 4 a.m. and danced in my 66-year-old birthday suit. My guide dog would not even get close to me. I did warn him that I did not want to dance on his landmines. I celebrated. Bob, thank you for your hard work, and thanks to Mike Malloy for telling me about the horn. You see, Bob, when I was in college, I joined SDS. To organize my brothers, I studied Emma Goldman. I listened to Joe Hill. My master's degree was sociology, specializing in the study of Appalachia. I bought any book written by or about the hills. I still have many of them. I got my master's, but I had to give up organizing and studying. You see, I have toxoplasmosis. It's a special gift from the hills, and it finished my vision off. I've given up hope that Appalachians would ever again receive an adequate education or jobs. I feel there's hope again. I dream that Berea College can educate more students, that Alice Lloyd and that Alice Lloyd College can support more students. I have a dream of riding through the coolness of the hills and hollers and smell the trees without the scent of the polluted mine water. There may be real hope again. I hope that we are not being fooled again. The end of times may truly be upon us. Holy shit. Clayton adds, and I'll try to do my best, we need, or at least I do, a description of S-696 and the EPA regulations and cap and trade and cap and trade. We are really in the weeds. And Scott did a pretty good job with cap and trade, I thought. But the problem is, it's all theoretical yet. And the fear is, as I gave voice to it, that it will be corrupted beyond any recognition of any help that it can give. Because, you know, we're in a... And, you know, this kind of goes into that whole thing, something we talked about months ago. There was an op-ed at Boston.com, out of the Boston Globe, I believe, talking about the fact that the American government is not cut out for crises. It is cut out to maintain the status quo, and is not. And real change only can be had when there is so much of a demand for it, and at the same time the ability to get it through Congress and the presidency and the courts, that it can be done. But you have to be a little bit hopeful. So I'm not going to try to go into any further into cap and trade. S-696 is very simple. It's called the Appalachian Restoration Act. It's a one-paragraph bill, and basically it ends valley fills. And if you can't do valley fills, then mountaintop removal is not very profitable. The EPA regulations, however, this new guidance has to do with the conductivity, which in turn has to do with the salinity of water. And if you want a good reason to support what the EPA has done, let me just read you the latest bulletin from the Friends of Coal. Dear Friends of Coal member, over the past 2 weeks, the federal EPA has mobilized a new war on West Virginia coal. First, it announced its intent to revoke a permit issued over 3 years ago, and just yesterday, it released ridiculous guidance on water standards that Mother Nature will be hard-pressed to meet. Either of these actions is enough to cause grave concern to the working men and women in the coal industry and across the state. Together, they represent perhaps the most serious challenge we have ever confronted to our way life and the way we earn our living. They are every bit as serious and threatening as the federal court decisions of the past. We have every intention of opposing these actions to the best of our abilities and will certainly need your support and assistance. Don't let EPA's rosy press statements mislead you. This is not about water quality, mountaintop mining, or surface mining. It's about coal jobs and the people of West Virginia. Because, after all, the people of West Virginia are conductive in their own rights, and we're worried about... But then again, you know, I've never seen the coal industry worry about the salinity of West Virginians before, and by God, we got us some, considering the high blood pressure rates we've got in the state, but never mind. The so-called guidance is effective immediately and represents a total disregard for the established, decades-old, congressionally sanctioned process for developing true water quality standards. See, that's the thing. These aren't true water quality standards. These are phony water quality standards because they tested phony water. All right? Yeah. So there's a good... But we'll do more. We will do more as time goes on. I wanted to share this with you from our buddy, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, who also opined on the issue of the Vatican, the Pope's personal priest today. I sent the link to the story off to Eugene Finnerman at FinnermanWorks.com. And he, of course, faithful correspondent that he is, wrote back and said, well, Bob. Jesus had a worse day than I did, but it still hasn't been a good Friday for me. My crucifixion was only metaphoric, but it was still in Italian hands. Santucci Plumbers. When our water bill tripled, we had to ask the municipality to reread the water meter. A municipal inspector found that we had some rather expensive leaks, and so we had to get a plumber. 2 hours later, and $328 poorer, we're hoping the problems have been solved. The next water bill should tell us. As for the article itself, I'm sure that the Vatican Media Department has issued a clarification by now. Of course, we didn't mean that the Jews are attractive enough to molest. Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill, obviously not. Maybe Fred Savage when he was really young. But Corey Haim certainly wouldn't have been worth the trouble getting to third base, or the 11th station of the cross, for that matter. No, we were only comparing the fact that we are claiming a statute of limitations for what we did, and the Jews are claiming one for what they didn't do. Eugene says, if I had more time to expound on this subject, I might recommend the repeal of the Council of Trent. Meeting in the mid-16th century as a belated response to a few defections in Northern Europe, the Church attempted to clean up its more sordid corruption. It would still be in bed with the most repressive regimes in Europe, hello Spain, but not with any attractive Italian women. This time it was going to be serious about celibacy, so Renaissance versions of Frank Langella would no longer be hitting on the ancestral prototypes of Sophia Loren, Claudia Cardinale, and Monica Bellucci. Well, that takes the arch out of the Archbishop. Until that council, the cardinals actually did not even have to take religious orders, so they ignore the celibacy as easily as they did the vows of poverty. The council did not exactly cure Protestantism, but it did keep unbridled heterosexuals out of the clergy. Of course, that led to other problems. Instead of child support, the prelates are spending fortunes on hush money. In hindsight, the church was better off when its bastards were merely literal. And that from the Internet's most brilliant satirist, Eugene Finnerman, finnermanworks.com. You can subscribe for free to Your RDA of Irony, and you will be ever so glad you did. I look forward to every time the little mailbox blinks, and it's something from Eugene. Brilliant, scholarly, and with a wit like a finely honed razor blade. It's exquisite. His work is brilliant. And so we go forward to the phones, and we see who is still there with us or not. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Rick.
Hey, Rick, how are you, brother?
I'm doing good. Well, not really. I'm kind of pissed, but not too bad. How's everything going over there?
Well, we've the knock wood again. We've made it through 2 hours and 16 minutes of show, which is an hour and 16 minutes of show better than we made it through last night.
Yeah, I've been trying to get on. I got kind of knocked off a couple of times, but that's mine on this side. Yeah, I was listening to you last night, and it did keep going in and out. What I've been able to hear of you tonight's been on pretty well. Oh, gosh. Back to your first caller. What y'all were touching on was that, you know, the people here in the South, the white guys, who are doing all this crazy enough stuff about their country, they're like Europeans, early Europeans. They just didn't realize that the rest of the world was brown. You know,
just because they hadn't got out much.
Blue eyes, blonde, and light-skinned is an abnormality. It's not normal. And so, you know, they put together all the strength that they could, and they went, gosh, there's more of them than they are of us. Let's make them into colonies. And then they didn't care how they mistreated them, what they stole from them, or how they died. Same thing that happened when they came to America. Although America was full, it was completely empty. So it was just a matter of brown people don't count. Even though us blue-eyed blonde people are kind of outnumbered.
Yeah, but don't tell the blonde-haired blue-eyed people that, or at least, you know, not the ones in the militias or. Yeah, and there's not even that many real blondes left, Rick. I mean, that's why there's such a brisk business in hair dye.
Amen. I actually know one true blonde here in Texas, just one. Isn't that amazing? I know a lot of bottled ones, but just one absolutely true one. The next thing is, I am so happy that everybody is so happy about this health care. I am so glad that everybody is being able to breathe a sigh of relief and say, we did it, we stuck it to them. Finally, after all these years of them slapping us around, we stuck it to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not so sure we did, but.
Well, let's take a look at it. How does what passed differ from what came up in the 1990s?
Oh, it's almost a dead rewrite from what the Republicans were proposing in 1994.
And Mitt Romney, what he put through, basically the same thing.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly not the universal health care that we need.
And it isn't what we voted for. It isn't at all. But we've been thrown a bone, and now we're supposed to sit back and chew on that bone. I have a lot of problems with that. Not because, you know, this is something that's needed. And yes, even though it's Republican, it's going to help. But it's not what we voted for. And it's not going to help what needs to be helped. And we can sit back and we can be very happy about it. But we got two other things coming down the pike right now. And we already see Obama doing his two-step. The two-step is this. He steps over to the right as far as he can, and he calls that senator, and he says, let's do this. Republicans go, wow, hey, that's what we were suggesting, you know, on drilling, on everything that happens in Appalachia. So then they step two steps over and wait for him to step over to the right again. This health care bill is not liberal. I don't even think it's progressive. It is Republican.
The only thing that is, Rick, is the Medicaid stuff. And that really matters.
It does really matter. And there's it's going to help. I just wanted more. And I'm not going to give him a pass on it. I'm sorry.
No, I say we, you know, the only way that we continue to improve on this is by continuing to raise hell. The most obvious fix is Alan Grayson's bill.
Absolutely. But, you know, this could go on, this fix could go on. It could have been fixed. It could have. He could have threatened Congress members. We could have actually done something and got this fixed immediately. It didn't, because he kept doing the two-step to the right. And he's doing the same thing now with energy and the environment. It's the same thing. And we're going to end up with the same kind of garbage. You have Marcus Melissa, Mr. Liberal himself, Daily Coast, getting up, and before the vote saying, we need to run a challenger against Kucinich if he doesn't vote for this. Now, when has he said we need to run something against the 30 that voted against it?
That would be never.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This kind of stuff kind of pisses me off.
Well, you know, I took real issue with Jane Hampshire's position too. This idea of, you know, never mind, you know, just kill the whole thing outright, and if we can't, you know, if we can't have it all, we don't want any of it. Because that's a hell of a thing to say to 45,000 people who are going to be dead a year from now.
It is. It is. It absolutely is. But in a way, look, to begin with, it didn't have to be done that way. You could have forced them to vote for something that was Democratic instead of Republican. Maybe less dream liberal instead of conservative. I really believe that we could have. And I believe that if we would have stood strong, it would have happened. We had basically seven people in Congress saying, no, no, no. You got to give everything over to the Republicans. And we had 40 liberals who says no. But then they're the ones who caved. And Obama knew they were going to cave. Rahm Emanuel knew that they were going to cave. And they know they're going to cave on the next things, too.
Do you think there will be any cost to them down the road? I mean, I know that some was announced that as far as Obama going and campaigning for people, that, you know, he doesn't have time to go campaign for people who work against him.
Yeah.
That was a fairly clear signal. Now we'll see if he does.
I think I've always said that he's too right-wing. He's always been too right-wing for me. Okay, centrist.
Well, the frustrating thing for me was that footage, Rick, of him in the Illinois Senate saying everybody knows that the only true solution to our health care crisis is universal single payer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's A, true, and it's him saying that it's true.
Right, but then he completely forgets it. It was attainable. It was attainable this year. We could have done it this year. The right was too tore up. Now, basically, what we got was what the insurance companies wrote. They did two front attack. They were writing this and at the same time attacking it, hoping they could just wipe it off and not get anything.
Yeah, oh, there's no small amount of don't throw me in that briar patch.
Right. And they're perfectly happy being in that patch. They got exactly what they wanted, and we got screwed.
They got 30 million new customers. Come on.
That taxpayers are paying for.
But we can't really gripe about the taxpayers are paying for it because we as taxpayers want to pay for single payer, right?
Absolutely. I have no problem with that at all. And if we did it the way we were supposed to do it, we'd actually be paying less taxes than they do in Europe.
And if it's true, you know, the thing that's disturbing is the good, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, Rick. Mm-hmm. And I think of, and if it is true, that the plan of the Johnson administration upon passing Medicare was to lower the age 10 years in 5 years and another 10 years and to have, you know, administrations that would continue to do that. Well, you know, we would have been at single payer a long time ago.
We would have been there a long time ago. If we would have accepted this very exact same bill in the 1990s, we would be there today.
True.
Instead, we just...
But the thing is, there was no deal to accept because the Republicans only posited that stuff in 1994 as a means of defeating what they called Hillary Care.
Right. I agree.
And I mean, just as the Republicans said, well, you know, if you'll just work with us now, if you'll just scrap it, scrap everything and start over from zero, we'll work with you. Is there anybody within the sound of our voices, Rick, that believes they really would have done that? Because I don't.
Of course not. And I do believe that this is a different time than it was. I was there in the 90s. This is different. We actually had the votes. We could have forced it. We had somebody with the strength and ruthlessness. By the way, where's Ruth? Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I know. You can never find her.
Yeah. Of Johnson, we could have got single payer. But to hear so-called liberals get up and say, we need to throw out of office our biggest liberal, Kucinich, that pisses me off to no end. And I can't wait to get to Las Vegas. I hope to have a nice little talk to that gentleman.
Oh, he's a celebrity now. Not much chance.
Well, I think I'll be able to get a couple of words into him. Anyway.
I do have to ask you, though, Rick, because it's your neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
These Guardians of the Free Republic, do you know anything about this radio creep down there? Sam Kennedy?
I have not heard of him. Sam Kennedy,
All it says here is that he is a Texas talk show host. And he's gotten whatever station it is he broadcasts from in hot water over these 30 letters to 30 governors telling him they have 3 days to get out.
Is he the one that sent that?
He's the one that got that ball rolling.
Oh, good Lord. Well, I hope he goes to jail.
The Guardians of the Free Republics is centered by this this Sam Kennedy character.
Why in the name of God does everything really crazy have to come out of Texas?
Well, because occasionally West Virginia, Kentucky, and Mississippi and Arkansas have to get some relief.
Now, you would think that, but, you know, you watch the news of all those crazy-ass people up there yelling and screaming, and you always see a Texas flag in the background. No matter what state they're in, Nevada, Kentucky, Washington, it doesn't matter. You always see a stupid Texas flag.
But you want to hear the fun part?
What's that, sir?
Republic Broadcasting Network is a satellite shortwave and internet radio station that features 31 shows with names like Cutting Through the Matrix, Govern America, and Road Warrior Radio. I'm sorting through the article kind of on the fly, but there's a character quoted in here named Stadtmiller. Mr. Stadtmiller apparently is behind, John Stadtmiller runs Republic Broadcasting Network in Round Rock, Texas. Where's Round Rock, Rick?
Round Rock is just north of Austin. It's actually the top of a volcano.
Okay, well, Republic Broadcasting Network is based in Round Rock, Texas, and Kennedy has a weekly Take No Prisoners show. What a guy. So John Stadtmiller runs it, and he said, I talked to Kennedy a half hour ago, and I told him I'm getting a lot of heat, that you stirred the pot here, and that your plan for how to deal with the media and let them know what is going on has failed miserably. And then he went on, this is the fun part. You said you hope they arrest him, prosecute him, convict him, and imprison him? For his part, Mr. Stadmiller says he would have pulled Kennedy's show immediately if there was any indication of violence. He advertises Republic as truth radio station and says it's designed for peaceful resolution to problems we're facing. And then he says, my understand, let's see, oh, where is it? Stadmiller says the FBI agents told Kennedy, in essence, we know you're not a threat, but we spent millions of dollars guarding governors. The next time you do something like this, give us a heads up. Don't waste our time and money.
Okay, well, you want to know what type of people hanging around out there? Round Rock is just across the corner from where that idiot in the airplane that flew it into IRS lived. Same neighborhood.
Oh, and on the website, that guy, Whack-a-Stack, has been hailed as a hero.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, complete nut who refuses to pay his taxes, the hero.
Nice, huh?
It's America. Anyway, I do appreciate, sir, that you allowed me to do my screaming. I have been wanting to do that forever, but I've been wanting to allow everybody to have their happy days first before I...
Well, you know, I don't look at it as screaming, Rick. I look at it as a very sober recognition of the fact that there is still work to be done.
If we don't hold them somewhat accountable for the mess that they did with the health care, and I still think that's a mess, no matter how much good it's going to do, then the next items that come up, they're going to screw us too. He's going to two-step all the way over to the right and call it center. Someone has to start holding him accountable, and I'm not hearing it from anybody. It's driving me up a tree.
Well, our buddy David in Tennessee is noting health insurance reform isn't what it should be. He says, but I see Obama taking action on financial and banking reform based on that modest success. I see the modest gain in health insurance reform emboldening the Democrats to get behind Barney Frank and reel in some banking thieves. There's more at stake, basically.
I agree, my friend. I agree 100%. The only problem is, look at what they're doing now. They're throwing out the window where the consumer protection is going to be. Not even bargaining it away, throwing it out and putting it back under the same people who had it before. I'm sorry, guys. We're ended up with the same stuff.
Well, if anybody knows a Texas two-step, it would be you, Rick.
Love you all, guys.
All right.
Have a good night.
Take care, and watch your back while you're down there and stuff. There's some crazy people down there, Rick.
I'm crazier than they are. Didn't you know that?
That's the only thing that makes me able to sleep at night.
See you later, my friend.
Later, Rick. Bye now. Horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. And let's see, are you guys still there? Yeah. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, I'm going to have to agree with Rick because the banking stuff that's coming down, it's a lot of kabuki, smoke and mirrors, because not only with the, the Consumer Protection Agency and the Fed, but the biggest problem that we have are these derivatives that aren't priced. And they've done everything to keep them that way. So the over-the-counter derivative markets, it still is going to be opaque going forward. I mean, this is bad. It's really bad. And it's very boring, so I'm not going to go into it. But what it is just the same as what was before, except now these banks are even bigger with more political clout. So it's not an economic issue anymore. It's a strictly political issue. And unfortunately, I don't see the crack that we should see. It's really quite disturbing what's coming down. Maybe there'll be some bait and switch that I'll miss. But so far, the main thing you want to be concerned about are these derivative markets. I mean, even the California treasurer is asking some questions about these credit default swaps. He wants to know, well, are you going to be betting against us on what you're selling us, basically? And he's getting a big fat cricket. But it's interesting that he's asking. And I know it's not in the news, but that was in the Financial Times. It's very interesting that California is like, hey, hold up, we need some more information.
Well, California's in a position. Wouldn't that be financially prudent? I mean, you know, best practices or whatever you want to call it to ask those questions?
Yeah, duh. No, this is, yeah, exactly, Bob. This should have been going on from day one. But the fact that they got enough guts now to step up is interesting, you know, which means that they're in some deep shit, you know, because, you don't want the bonds or whatever you're buying to be betted on again. See, Lochner looks at Greece and he sees California. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what's going on. And so he's asking a few questions about these really complicated, by design, credit default swaps that, you know, you or I are like, you know, your eyes glaze over, right?
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's a big problem, you know? And the fact that the bill that's coming down out of the financial committee, it isn't even getting a look-see on that, you know, is a worry.
Well, what does it say, Sandra, when Bob Corker, you know, Bob Jungle Drums Corker.
Oh, God, I can't stand that.
I know,
yeah.
I know. He says, well, you know, I want to work with Senator Dodd. And Senator Dodd says, okay, we'll work together. And then Senator Corker says, that's just Josh, and I don't want to work with you. I ain't going to vote for that piece of... And leaves, you know, even though Dodd's leaving the Senate, leaves Dodd with egg on his face. You know, it's one last good spit on the nose. So, you know, why not go back and do it our way and either jam it through or get not, this, and I hate to seem callous, and I will probably get corrected for this, but this is slightly less critical than health care, right? Or is it on a par?
Oh, what you mean,
the so-called reform, financial, yeah.
No, listen, everything is ass backwards, Bob. I'm sorry. The healthcare thing is critical, but that wasn't the first thing. The first thing he should have taken care of was double the stimulus that he did, then take these goddamn too-big-to-fail banks down, jobs, and then this healthcare. So, I'm sorry, you know.
Oh, I know, and, you know, here we are celebrating another month of, hey, we didn't lose any more jobs.
Well, yeah, but even, and even that picture is real murky because some of the indices that we don't see on the front page has, like, increased because the U6 has gone back up. It's not as high as it was in January, which was 17, but it's, like, 16.8%.
Did you catch where, even holding even, isn't safe, from the, you know, the batshit crazy Republicans. Did you see where that the Republicans are trying to blame these latest, you know, nothing really to shout from the rooftops about numbers on the fact that, well, that's the reason there was no, that's mostly just census workers.
Well, the private sector, I think, increased 120,000 jobs. So, I mean, you know, that is some real movement in the sector that matters as far as our economy goes right now is, you know, to see how private industry is working. But at the same time, I heard that the corporations are sitting on something like $1.6 trillion in cash, Bob. That's the most. That's more.
Well, that's your get-out-of-town money.
Well, no, that's more than the peak of 2007. And what's so disturbing about that is because you have millions of people with no jobs and you have them sitting on that. Don't tell me there's not a correlation. You know, I'm not hearing it. What I'm looking at is
Well, sure there's a correlation.
Well, it's just the impoverishment of Americans because these bitches need to be forced to reinvest to create jobs. But because the tax code is so skewed, they don't have to. They just pay bonuses and offshore it and invest in workshops in China, you know?
Well, you know, you just got a little fan mail in. Sandra needs to be president. She's reading and comprehending so much more than I can even understand. Brilliant woman. And, but because it look, and it's no insult to anybody, myself included, to affirm you when you say this is stuff that's hard to get your head around.
Oh, no, listen, I just barely scratched scrape the surface, and it's only because, you know, I kind of just read it and try to think about it, but I don't understand the derivative markets. I can't comprehend that it's $400 trillion or something like that floating around the world. What is that? What is that?
Those are astronomy numbers.
Well, yeah, they sure are, and that's exactly the way it feels. It feels, too. You're right about that. Those numbers, when you think about how far away stars and stuff are, yeah, you can't even wrap your head around it. I mean, even the language they use to describe the distance isn't comprehensive.
We have expressions like light year. Maybe we need light money expressions.
No, I think you're onto something with that, because the astronomy, yes, it definitely is in the same mode when you talk about these evil derivatives. And what's really disturbing is that there's no reason why sovereign states have to put up with this. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes.
They can say, screw you, and what's going to happen? They can print their own money up and have a closed economy for a bit if they need to. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, a couple of days ago, I had a little blast email. I mentioned them earlier, the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, you know, this is a group that is union-oriented. It was created by the steel workers. And lo and behold, the usual province of a union is jobs. And that's largely been the Alliance for American Manufacturing's province, is saying, you know, we need to be manufacturing here in the U.S., you know, yada, yada, yada. I opened an email from them the other day, and lo and behold, what's the blast in it? The United States and President Obama have absolutely got to start dealing with Chinese currency manipulation. And there's an element of truth to that. But before we can even talk to China about currency, don't we have, based on what you're saying, don't we have some people in the United States manipulating the currency? I mean, really, if you talk about inflation, if you talk about jobs, if you talk about that $1 trillion just sort of laying there gathering dust.
You mean what the Chinese are holding?
No, I'm talking about what the American corporations are holding, banks.
That's
currency manipulation in its own right, isn't it?
That's what we need to be dealing with. The Chinese thing is almost becoming a red herring, because guess what? Do you think that they're going to give up that $1.4 trillion they have? What are they going to do? Put it on the market and start and lose the little interest that they're getting? No, they won't. That's just some BS that we're constantly being assaulted with. I'm so over it. Because no one in their right mind in the Chinese government is going to say, we don't want the U.S. treasuries anymore.
Those
motherfuckers be shot.
Yeah.
They could take it out and shot if they did something like that right now. So... You know
but
what
what's that? What's that $1.7 trillion doing? The stuff that Wall Street's just sitting around counting. What's it doing, Sam?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, no, that is the big question when you have 15 million Americans unemployed. I'm just talking. All it shows me is that we have been decoupled. They don't give a F about America. It's globalized, and you know what I mean. I just think it's that kind of party. We don't have a clue as to how they're operating now.
We supposed to.
Well, I mean, people keep talking about, you know, coming back to a natural unemployment rate, you know, which it used to be 5%, if you can imagine. But I don't envision that happening, I don't know, ever. You know,
well, because that rate that we're talking about, the one that's holding steady, what is it, 9.7, 9.8?
We know that
I'm not trying to be hard on the administration, but that's a finessed number, and it was a finessed number under Bush, and it was a finessed number under Clinton. Whatever the number is, it's been finessed.
Well, the thing in China, China's dealing with some bubble issues. And because, you know, let's say what it is, China is an authoritarian, they don't have elections, you know, part of their economy is market, some is not. You don't know what's going on there.
No, because the part that's authoritarian is the part that deals with the money.
Well, yeah, and, you know, there's some, you know, that makes some sense, I mean, how they're managing it, but as far as, like, the sort of dirty float that the U.S. want them to engage in? Yeah, I don't know, you know. What was that email saying they need to do? Devalue it or increase it? You know, which one is it? Each way has huge implications, you know?
Yeah, it does. And that was the question that I was led to. It's like choosing which way you want to be executed.
Well, I'm just saying, it's like, you know, you have this sort of fake floating system we're supposed to be under. And I say fake because it's more of a dirty float. And in fact, it's fantasy land because there's nothing pegged. What is it pegged to? The military expenditures? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What the hell? The dollar, you know, really. What is it? What's backing it at this point? You know, you tell me.
So with the worldwide derivative stuff that's floating out there, that's another global bubble, right?
Well, yeah. Well, it's just sort of, you know, that whole mark to market, which is now mark to magic. You know, there used to be a rule where you had to mark assets to market. And the Congress changed that to mark the magic, as far as I can tell.
Well, Ron and Raleigh, noting, you know, the thing is that the GDP of the entire planet, $65 trillion, a $400-plus trillion derivative market, is unsustainable of itself. The derivatives market needs to be regulated along with hedge funds.
Yeah, it needs to be. It needs to be unwound, as they like to say, or at least priced. But see, these banks don't want to do that. Because they're insolvent, you know.
You know, not to be overly simplified, but that's often the only way I can get my head around some of this stuff, Sandra. What we're essentially talking about is the Dutch tulip market of the 17th century.
Egg, bingo. Yes, that BS. Yeah, that was like the big.
You know, when tulip bulbs were being traded for,
right,
you know,
right,
50,000 cronkites or whatever.
Is that the South Sea bubble? Or is that
that's a different animal.
Oh, God.
This the Dutch went absolutely mad for tulips. Well, do you remember the best modern example of that? Do you remember the TY Beanie Baby craze of the 90s?
Oh, right. Yes, that I used to be shaking my head at the time thinking, what? Yes, okay, yeah, no.
And it would be, you know. Well, I've got one of the rare bears that's got a thread out of place on its left front paw.
No, weren't people paying...
And people would say, oh, that's a $30,000 bear.
No, they were paying hundreds for those, I remember.
No, thousands, really, not kidding.
No, just, yes, okay, yeah, that...
And now they're in gumball machines.
But, you need to stop. Well, listen, anyway, this conversation can sort of go on forever because it's just so weird. But basically what I'm trying to say is that what they're trying to do in Washington, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem to touch what we need to get, you know, under control. But I don't know if you have any breaking news music.
Yeah, well, no, I can. Go, Sandra.
Okay, Obama. Black on the census.
No.
Yes.
Well, here's hoping he had more luck with that than his final four picks.
Oh, my gosh. I just thought that was funny. It's like, oh, okay, well, all right. And the article's like,
what did he write? Here's the booby prize question. What did he write for place of birth?
Oh, gosh, they didn't go there. You know, they didn't. No. Anyway, I just thought that was hilarious. But, I mean, because dude can't win, you know, so I guess he picked the...
I guess I got to check that one.
The path of least resistance.
One drop rule, you know.
Oh, my God. Hey, listen, this is the only other thing I just was dying. I thought of you. Laid off workers threaten to blow up French plant. They said, if you don't give us a better, severance deal, we're going to blow it up. They have, like, bombs around it. They don't play, okay?
Yeah, for all the hell we give the French, and you know, not me, But, you know, the right-wingers and so forth. I think the reason that they try to heap that scorn on the French, Sandra, is precisely because a French worker will not take that crap, and they don't want the American people looking up and going, what? Wait, that's the French?
Yeah, no, employees at the Sodom Madex plant placed petrol bombs near a large gas tank and were threatening to set them on fire. Some mealy-mouthed government official came out and said, this is unacceptable, but them motherfuckers are sitting down at a table with them. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, c'est horrible, c'est inacceptable. Right.
I mean, you know, and the thing is, and the people, you know, they may look kind of funny, but at the end of the day, the people are, like, supporting this. They're like, yes. So I think the government...
Well, and you know, that's and that's the funny thing the surrounding all that. You know, Nicolas Sarkozy, who is within the scope of European definitions, a radical right-winger, you know, how galling is it to have him come to the United States and say, welcome to the community of the world that no longer throws its poor to the curb?
Oh, no, I heard him say that. I said, oh, what a kiss ass. You know, shut up. You know, I know he was having dinner with Obama. I mean, no, I could have done without that. But see, his ass has lost, you know, quite a few regional and local elections to the socialists. So he's kind of in trouble at the moment.
But there was a certain irony in him saying, in him, you know, him being a hard right winger and saying that. And then following up by saying, well, you know, if you get sick in the France, we will not first ask you for, we will take you to the hospital. We will not first ask you for your credit card.
Oh, did he finish it off like that?
Yeah.
Oh, no, he went all the way there. I just thought he was just trying to prop up Obama. Shut up. That's funny. Oh, no. Well, I don't know. I love these stories about the French workers. I mean, they are some tough-minded people, you know?
Oh, and this coming in from Ron in Raleigh. He said, hey, Bob, I wonder what box Charlize Theron checked. African-American? You know, because she was born and raised in South Africa and everything, so.
I thought he was going to say she was some crackers playing some black person like Angelina Jolie. Remember that?
Yep.
when she played that Pearl, I'm like, they could not find a sister to play Pearl's wife. Hello?
You know what I love, though, speaking of which, this right-wing freakout, you know, they're kind of having second thoughts about flipping out about the census because, among other people, Representative Patrick McHenry, Repiglican of North Carolina, has suddenly woke up to the fact that it may be his ass if the numbers don't come in good. And it turns out that McHenry made mention of the fact that some of the most Republican counties in Texas have had some of the lowest census return rates in the country. And, you know, that's not good for the Republican Party. But even with that out there, Eric Erickson, the new hire at CNN for his best political team
guy?
The red state guy. Was talking about the thing that goes along with the census, the American Community Survey, which is legally mandated, required by Title 13 United States Code, Section 14, 141, 193, and 221. He said, you know, in front of a microphone on his radio show for, you know, over the public airwaves, he said, this is crazy. What gives the Commerce Department the right to ask me how often I flush my toilet? Well, it's Eric Erickson, so I wouldn't figure he flushes the toilet at all. Or about going to work, I'm not filling out this form. I dare them to try and come and throw me in jail. I dare them to pull out my wife's shotgun and see how that little ACS twerp likes being scared at the door. They're not going on my property. They can't do that. They don't have the legal right, and yet they're trying. So, you know, please, Republicans, don't fill out your census form.
Dear God. Oh, my God. No, I mean, I was just rolling at Rick's call when he was talking about why is it that you see a Texas flag every time these freaks pop up on video.
Yeah, but you know what? Texas getting some relief. Down at the University of Central Florida, Glenn Beck was showing up. I don't know if you saw this or not. Glenn Beck was showing up for a personal appearance.
Oh, Oh, God.
And some guy with a fraternity at UCF got one of those event parking the posters, you know, yellow, black letters, event parking, big arrow.
Yeah.
And herded a whole just 53 cars into a parking lot and then had them all towed because it was a tow-away zone. And so every Glenn Beck fan paid something like $260 to get his car out of hock.
Are you kidding?
Nope.
Oh, my God. Wow.
What a beautiful thing, you know? And they had the tow truck driver going, this is the biggest business day I've ever had in my life. I made $6,000.
Exactly. Listen, that's hilarious. You know what? They are so freaking stupid. It's mind-boggling.
And you know, you got some little teabagger on their side. I ain't never coming to another event at the University of Central Florida. No, never, not never. This ain't fair.
Fair? Oh, wait a minute.
Fair?
There's no fairness in there. No, that shouldn't even be.
That's market economics. I mean, you wouldn't want regulation of parking lots or nothing, would you?
No, I mean, fairness shouldn't even be in their mouths. That word. Are you kidding? Wait a minute. These are the same people, though, who collected all kinds of government checks, though, right?
Same.
Unbelievable. But that college thing is hilarious, though.
And it was a fraternity boy, too. I'm loving that. Apparently, it was the Kappa Sigma chapter at the University of Central Florida.
Okay, now is that a big sports school or is it just?
No, not so much. You know. That's one of those Florida schools based on a point on the compass. You know, there's Miami, there's Florida, there's Florida State, and then the rest of them I just generically refer to as Florida Compass Point.
Oh, God. No, I mean, you know, don't give me stuff. I mean, Florida, you know, I've been down to Florida a couple of times, and yeah, I like Florida, I have to say, but there's some weird people down there, though.
Well, I just love the idea of a bunch of fraternity boys sitting around in the tube room seeing that Glenn Beck's going to be on the UCF campus and going, and laying out the idea and somebody sticking his hands up and going, wait, and having, you know, having Hoover over here in the corner going, no, don't stop him, he's on a roll. You know, straight out of Animal House. And, you know, no, what we'll do, now, remember the event thing, the event site? Yeah, remember we stole those? Yeah, we'll use them again. And we'll drive them into our parking lot, and then we'll have all the little Beck heads towed.
Yeah, but is Beck going to cover that for his faithful followers?
Oh, hell no. He's a free market capitalist.
Well, are those frat boys getting into trouble?
No. I mean, because the sign didn't have the University of Central Florida's name or website or great seal or nothing on it. Just yellow sign, black letters, event parking. They didn't say which event.
Oh, my God. That's
free market, caveat, emptar, sunshine.
My God, that's a good one. Jesus Christ. Okay, well, listen, I'll let you go. Oh, shoot. What's the setup for the game, though? You got to give me that run.
You will want to be in front of your television with your CBS affiliate at 5:47 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time tomorrow. Bob Huggins still saying that Truck Bryant, no matter how hard we prayed on Wednesday, Truck Bryant is very unlikely to play.
Oh, shoot. Well, what do you think that's – I mean, I guess that's the case. It's not a bait and switch.
Bob Huggins, sandbag? No, not him. No.
No, this poor kid, though, he really wants to play because I know he was talking about it.
Oh, he does. And you know what? If he can't play, Huggins will have to shackle him to the chair.
I mean, both games are played tomorrow, though, right?
No, I think the other one's Sunday.
The other one's Sunday?
No. They're both tomorrow.
But the Virginia game is first.
Yeah, 8:40. No, I think we're the second game. Because,
oh, the second one.
Yeah,
okay.
Because our tip-off's at 8:47. Because the highest seed guy always gets the prime spot, and Duke is the only remaining number one seed.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I think we're still, what, 4.5-point dogs? Which
really?
Is fine. Yeah, which is fine by me. I wouldn't want those guys going into a game being favored. I'm a Mountaineer fan, and bad things happen when we're favored.
Yeah, I know. I hear what you're saying.
But I do hope we shoot a little better. I think we've got the lowest shooting percentage, lowest average shooting percentage of a Final Four team, like since John Wooden quit coaching or something. We're shooting 40.1%.
And you think that has to be bumped up with this Duke squad?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like it better because I want to win, but with it, what would it be in Duke? I'd like to win by about 15, 20 points. I'd like Jerry West's two left-footed son to come on the court and dunk over one of those shiny-faced thugs. I'd just like that because I'm that way and I'm mean, spoiled, and shallow.
Well, I mean, I'm envisioning Michigan and Virginia. I have to say, just because Michigan, that's a pretty scrappy team.
Oh yeah, they are. I would. Butler is, I think, a 1.5-point dog, and I wouldn't hesitate to take that in a minute if I was a gambling guy. I mean, no, I think Michigan State's going to do this.
Well, it's only because, I mean, they got so much experience at this point, if that means anything. And also the coaching.
Tom Izzo knows how to get a team through the tournament. It just does.
Yeah, but anyway, listen, it's the end of your show, so I'll let you go. But, I'll be thinking about you when I'm watching it.
Yeah, I'll just periodically shout, "Let's go, Mountaineers."
Okay.
All right. Take care, Sandra.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Let's see. I'm going to do this. No. 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 Okay. I didn't leave anybody on hold. Oh, Butler's. I'm sorry. Butler's a favorite. Oh, my bad. My bad. Michigan State's the 1.5-point dog, which, yeah, take that all day long. Hey, the show's over. And we got through it. No buffering, no nothing. It was nice and normal, and hallelujah. We are into April, fresh month. Sorry to say it. Need your help. Always need your help. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com under the Contribute tab, as is the snail mail address. Bless your hearts. The fact that there is, well, I mean, look, what I was talking about with Rick Goodner. There's a Republic Radio Network in Round Rock, Texas, and they've got the wherewithal to air this filth and this hate, and they're actually, they pay people. They're not just struggling to survive. Us, we're good little liberals. We're just trying to keep the lights on. So, if you can, it would be much appreciated. It's been a wonderful week. I look forward to being back here on Monday. Have a wonderful, if you celebrate Easter, or Astarte, or any particular goddess or anything, at the happy close of Passover to you. We will have a spam lamb on Sunday. No, I'm kidding. But at any rate, have a happy holiday weekend. We'll see you Monday. Thanks to everybody who makes all this happen on the behind the microphone side, from Sue, our co-webmistress, and chat room moderator, to Lottie, to Peter Godbold, John Fox, who may actually, we hope, come your way Sunday night at 9 p.m. with all foxed up, if he hasn't been worked to death again this weekend. So many of us work at work. It just keeps getting in the way. To Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne, OsborneInc.com. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger, Texas Betsy. To my head writer, David in Tennessee, thanks. Thanks to the hardest working people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. You are seeing and hearing about the fruits of their labors. Remember, Action Point with Cynthia Black comes your way this weekend, roughly 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Adjust for whatever time zone you are in. It's a great show. It's a wonderful show. Cynthia does a wonderful job. And before that, the Rick Smith Show coming to you from Pennsylvania. All of that on the way this weekend on the Horn. And always, 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 Gina. It's all for you.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Now, where were we? Let's see. When last we spoke, you probably heard me sort of fading off into the distance. Flag staggin' vassal frassel that nash and blood not pulled neck racking. Yeah. Highly frustrating last night was. And frankly, I still don't, it's only fair warning, I still don't have the problem solved. So there's no guarantee that we'll make it through 3 hours tonight. But I hope you all have a very happy holiday weekend. My weekend will be made deliriously happy with a victory over the Duke. Come about starting about, 8:47 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Saturday evening when my beloved Mountaineers tip off against Mike Krzyzewski and his shiny-faced, smiling band of thugs. No, really, where were we? I'd just gotten the show started, got an hour of it under my belt, had very good news yesterday, and then nothing. But again, no guarantees about tonight either, because I haven't really solved the problem. I don't know if we've got a router problem, a wire problem, or the virus problem. All the virus scans say, no, it's not a virus issue. Among other things, our cavalcade of crazy correspondent from headonradionetwork.com, that's Reverbo, sent me a note earlier saying, when you find a spare 3 minutes, tell me why your internet signal just drops off like last night. Fortunately, it doesn't happen often. I wish it didn't happen never. Or I wish it happened never. Double negative there. Sorry. He says, Reverbo says, perhaps next time you'll put in a repair ticket with Central Services like you should have, because Central Services takes care of all repairs in the socialist bureaucratic nightmare world that you wanted, or at least in Terry Gilliam's wonderful world of Brazil from 1985, one of my favorite films. You know, Bob, if you try to fix things yourself, Central Services will find out. And then when they send Dowser and Spore, Bob Hoskins, over in clear hazmat suits, and caps with bills about a foot long, they will be none too pleased with you. Oh, how true. How true it is. How very true. And that's the thing. I've tried to get help from Central Services, but, you know, that's what happens when you try to, when you try to get help from Central Services. Uh, And this is, of course, so-called Good Friday. Marty noting that I may have teed off the Mossad or something. One never knows. One never knows. Hey, maybe I may have teed off the Guardians of the Free Republic. Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, we got that story in the stack tonight. How could we not? Oh, this is lots of stories in the stack tonight. But it is, you know, it is the Easter season. And it occurs to me to note that, yeah, I did, before the program, it was sort of an academic exercise. I went back and I read the Gospel of Mark, and I'm going to share a couple of chapters with you of it in a couple of minutes, because I want to make sure that you hear what I read, because I couldn't find that part in the Easter story where there's a rabbit being crucified next to Yeshua. I couldn't. Yeah. And maybe it's I don't know, maybe St. Eusebius or something covered that up, or that, who knows. But it occurs to me that Easter, this particular holiday, is as much a function of our common language as any...